Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
You're listening to Talk Radio. I am Mark Dolan.
And I'm Andre Walker. Today is a day that will live in infamy, not like just so many terrorist attacks before.
Now, over the next 3 hours, we're going to keep you up to date on the appalling events in central London this afternoon. We know that the Met Police are treating this as a terrorist attack. We're getting more information by the minute. We will keep you up to date. Two members of the public have been killed today, three injured in the attack. One of those injured is in a critical but stable condition. The second is in a stable condition. The third with less serious injuries. Police shot and killed the suspect on London Bridge. The suspect was wearing a fake explosives belt.
Where does yet another attack leave this country? Should we suspend campaigning in the general election? Is our response to global terrorism wrong? And do our police and security services have what they need to fight those people that seek to denigrate freedom, liberty and democracy? And what impact on all of this on community relations?
Well, obviously, these are questions that will be thrown up. We're all still reeling, I think, on a human level from what's happened. And two lost lives, two Londoners going about their business who have been killed in what is being treated as a terrorist incident. We're going to have all, obviously, of the developments and updates for you. But we'll also get some great analysis. We'll be speaking to Phil Campion, who's a former SAS trooper who's been in very difficult situations himself in his career as a soldier. Simon Trundle, who's a counter-terrorism expert, who can help us to understand, you know, how this person perpetrated this crime, how we might ever stop it, or do we need to get used to these kinds of attacks? And of course, this is not the first occasion in this part of London where we've seen an appalling terrorist attack. Honey Lancaster-Jones will join us, and she'll talk about the psychological aspect of this, not only for the family and friends of the victims, those injured, but even those who performed heroics. And we'll spend a lot of time on today's show talking about the bravery of several Londoners who have more or less put their own lives at risk in order to help others. And the stories of bravery will come through, but those people will bear the scars as well, maybe just mental. So we'll talk about the psychological aspect of it. And also, just as Brits generally, how safe, you know, do we feel, and should we be afraid? And statistically, you're always told how rare these occurrences are, but not rare enough, clearly. And we're going to kick things off, Andre, with David Lowe, Dr. David Lowe, who I believe is with us and ready. He is the former counter-terrorism detective and a lecturer now on the very same subject. Dr. Lowe, thank you for your time.
Yeah, good evening.
First of all, what is your reaction to what's happened? Is there a sense of weary acceptance that these things are going to be a regular feature of modern life, you know, in the Western world and particularly in the UK?
Well, I think if you put it in that context of the Western world, you know, and when we say regular, what do we mean by regular? I mean, we've been very, very fortunate in Britain that it's been just over 2 years since we've had an actual attack. So there is a degree of rarity about it happening, you know, compared to other things that we do in our daily lives. But yeah, it's always a tragedy. I mean, two people have died, and we've got one person who's very critical in hospital, because we have, as far as we know at the moment, one individual who's been inspired by some extremist content that we, you know, we'll wait for the police to give us more information, but, you know, who's decided to carry out what we call a low-level attack, an easy attack, have a sharply bladed instrument like a knife, and attack people. So it's always something that, you know, it has that terror effect. It still frightens us when it does happen, but, you know, it's still rare.
Now, we don't know, you know, who carried it out in terms of the organisation or the individual concerned. But one of the things that I think is a huge concern, if you look back to the IRA in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, they had the cell system, which meant that, you know, one cell would not know what the other cell was up to. And if you infiltrated one, you didn't infiltrate the rest. If you fast forward to today, you know, the internet and social media has made it so easy for individuals to act on their own. So you don't need a command. You don't need a cell system. You don't need anybody assisting you. You can just do this on your own. How difficult does that make it for the police and security services?
It is difficult. I mean, you know, mentioned my former service, and I was quite young. I was quite a young detective during the Irish Troubles, and I served in the branch for a short period of time. into that company. You're quite right. I mean, the Provisional IRA had what we would call a textbook operation in Britain. Their view was it was behind enemy lines, and it's exactly what you say. But I think what we can compare here is if a group wants to carry out what we call a high-level attack, you're now targeting the military, you're now targeting Parliament building, government
buildings,
so on,
yeah.
Right? If you're doing that, you need a cell network. You do need a cell network. What's a big concern, you're quite right to highlight this, because it's virtually impossible to stop, is if it just takes one individual who's inspired by some extremist content to go and do something. We saw it with Massoud. We saw it with Darren Osborne in 2017. Darren Osborne, there's no previous history to him. He just gets embroiled in certain far-right content, and he decides to carry out an attack. It's virtually impossible to stop. And you look at the tactics that they use, it's very difficult.
So can I kind of drill into that a little bit? Because we often hear at times like this, known to police. Now, my understanding is that there are thousands of people who are being watched because they are extremists. Now, the question is, are they extremists who are going to commit terrorism, or are they just extremists? How does, without giving anything away that's inappropriate, how does that system work?
Well, you're quite right. There's around 3,000 people who are being watched at the moment because they're being assessed as a risk. Obviously, the factors that will go into this is, don't forget, we have the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre that will collate a lot of intelligence that comes from various sources. And they work closely with the security services and the police. So they will assess who's at greatest risk, and who's at greatest risk is looking at their activities, looking at associations they're making, if we have things like, as you said, with the internet, we have the Investigatory Powers Act. There are warrants that can be obtained on specified persons or groups to monitor what they're accessing. They're not just given out willy-nilly. You have to have certain evidence to get these warrants. But intelligence, information, and it is frustrating where someone was being on, because, we talk about London Bridge, and you look at Karam Butt from 2017. He was watched, then he was assessed as a low risk. And, of course, the investigation later by the Intelligence and Security Committee and the coroner's inquest found, we know what happened. He was a risk, and his two associates. The problem is identifying that risk, and there's only limited resources, both staffing and technology and so on, that they have to look at. So it is making that assessment, and there's one thing the security says and the police want, they want to get it right, and it's absolutely gutting when it doesn't happen.
And does this have a flavour, and it's hard for you to prejudge at this stage, David, but does this feel like there might be a sense of regret that there have been any casualties today?
I think there's always regret. There's one thing in counter-terrorism policing you want to do is prevent it, prevent the small P, I don't mean the prevent strategy that's being looked at now. You want to prevent it, that means no one's been killed or injured. The worst thing is having to detect it and find out who did it. I mean, there's one thing that they'll be looking at in this investigation is, did he have any associates? Was there anyone else there? As I said, 2017, there were three males who were involved. did he have any assistants? So they'll go through all his communications, things he's been looking at, lots of evidence to go through, and it'll be a good while before we get the full details from the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you, my memory growing up in our capital city was of IRA attacks, and since then we've obviously seen Al-Qaeda, threaten our safety, 9/11, all the rest of it, then ISIS. And obviously, these are very sophisticated organizations that have had a huge fundraising arm, whether it's through organized crime or even donations. Sophisticated, rich, well-populated, platforms of terror and hatred. However, clearly that's counterintelligence. That's a sophisticated police approach. If there's a more or less a mentally unstable person who's got internet access and a large knife, how do you legislate against that?
It's very, very difficult. It really is. I think these warnings have been given for some time. Andrew Sanders, head of MI5, warned of this nearly 2 years ago. Neil Bazou's predecessor, he also warned of this. And even Neil Bazzi, who is the senior counter-terrorism police officer, has said, you know, how difficult it is. And that's why, you know, one of the things he was looking at, well, I briefly mentioned it before, the PREVENT strategy with a capital P that's in the CONTEST counter-terrorism program, is trying to those who are vulnerable being drawn towards terrorism. But we need more community work, and that's why there's a review ongoing by Lord Carlisle at the moment, looking at the effectiveness of PREVENT and how to improve it, I think will be the conclusions that comes out in June. So that's one way to deal with it. But as you said, you're looking at groups that are quite wealthy. But, of course, what we've been fortunate, and I know this may sound ridiculous to some people, we've been fortunate that we've not had the sort of attacks that the likes of Al-Qaeda and certainly Islamic State over the last few years have carried out. You look at what they've done in Syria, you look at what they've done in Iraq, you look at what they've done around the Middle East. Base, more sophisticated attacks than, I mean, they've attacked the U.S. Army, obviously UK, French. They've attacked what we call high-level attacks. We've been so fortunate they've not done it, which we saw, as we said, during the troubles with the Provisional IRA over here. You know, the Brighton bomb, they nearly, if the bomb was on the right floor, that could have killed the Prime Minister and other members of the Cabinet. Yeah. And they mortar-bombed 10 Downing Street. So it shows you that level of sophistication and capability is also important. They may, you know, we may be too far for them to have that capability to carry the attacks. I think that's why our threat level for Britain or the UK from the Islamist threat went from severe to substantial, but that may now be getting reviewed.
Yes, I mean, do you think that was a regrettable move? What could you help us in terms of how policymakers can decide the level of threat that we face as citizens? And do you think, you know, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but do you think that was a mistake?
Well, it's the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, JTAC, who comes out with it, and you know, and they will assiduously go through the intelligence, and one of the factors is the capability of a group to carry out an attack. Their influence may have waned, and those factors were there. I mean, we've been at severe for a long time. Severe is highly likely. I mean, substantial doesn't mean we can put our feet up and have a rest. It means an attack is likely, and that's what we've seen today. So, you know, it's a very serious process that's taken when assessing threat levels. I mean, if you go to Northern Ireland, it's still severe from dissident Irish republicanism. You know, so you look at each group's capability, and it's, you know, you look at like the new IRA, they're a threat in certain areas within the north, like to the Cregan and Derry. They are a threat there, but they're not a threat to Britain. We did go to substantial about 18 months ago, but we've dropped down now from that threat. So you assess each group and its own capability, but the key threat we've faced in Britain has been from the Islamist groups.
But Dr. Lowe, fundamentally, you're talking about two elements to kind of protecting Britain, aren't you? There's the intelligence that you're talking about, the ability to infiltrate groups, whether that be their communications or whether that be those incredibly brave members of the security service who physically infiltrate organisations. And then there's the guys on the ground that we saw today, police officers, frankly, with machine guns, running in and protecting the public. And both of those historically have been the way that we have protected ourselves. And the way that intelligence protects us is that, you know, it is quite hard to buy Semtex and machine guns, thankfully, in the United Kingdom. But when you are talking about an ability to commit a terrorist attack when you've just got a knife or rented a car, actually, do we say to ourselves that there aren't enough resources being put into policing? Because actually this becomes a much more frontline thing. Because whilst the Semtex and the guns and the IRA and Al-Qaeda is intelligence led, actually, when you're talking about a guy with a knife, you just need lots more physical security.
Yes, and I think also, again, I go back to, you know, there are some individuals who could have been helped earlier on if the PREVENT strategy was more effective, that would have been one way. But you're quite right. It's just so difficult. I mean, you know, how many of us hire a car? How many of us go and nip down to your local hardware store and buy some kitchen knives because we need the knives for doing the cooking and carving the meat, etc. Yeah, you know, there has to be a limit. And you're quite right. I mean, we have had the austerity cuts in policing since 2009, and although counter-terrorism policing hasn't had any cuts, while the demands have increased, unfortunately the staffing level has not increased correlatively with the number of attacks or the number of investigations investigations that they're running. So they're quite thinly spread too.
Well, it just strikes me that, bear in mind, every political party, to my knowledge, in the general election is saying that the police need more resources. But I feel as if we were to leave the amount of resources at the same level as we had, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, with the increased threat from these low-tech attacks, that still would not be, you know, staying in the same place. That would be a regressive move.
Yeah, you know, to have, as I said, to have an individual who certainly may not even be on the system to go and do this. I mean, I used Darren Osborne as a really classic example. There's a male who's gone about his business for years and years, never been in trouble with the police before, no record, and it happens, and you're quite right to highlight this point. But then, you know, we have to look at what measures we've learned. I mean, there's Christmas markets on at the moment, and I mean, I know the ones that I've seen. I mean, I was in Belfast the other week, Liverpool's is now on St. George's Plateau. It's hard to get in there. Leeds, the way they've located by the civic hall, it's hard to get vehicles into there. York has got barriers that they've placed. Some people objected to that, but what you're seeing is local authorities and that building up their resilience to terrorist attacks to look at that sort of thing. So if we now, made it difficult for vehicle attacks, it's now the problem is those who have a knife.
But didn't the Israelis prove that if you protect the bus, people just blow up the queue?
Yes, you know, when you look at the attacks that they've had over the years, because they've had similar attacks, we're talking over decades, that we were not used to until really, I think 9/11 brought it home to everyone, and certainly in the UK in 2005, it came home to suicide bombers, which we never had before. So it was learning a new tactic, it was learning a new cause, a new understanding, it was learning how they operated, and I think we've caught up, and I think one thing has shown today, and we have to do it. One, I think those, the passers-by who restrained that male, and you know, you've got to take the hat off to them, and it shows that sort of British phlegm of we're not having this anymore. And then you look at the response by the Metropolitan Police, it was within minutes, and it was very, very efficient. I think we've got to give them credit. If that hadn't have happened, there could have been more casualties.
Well, actually, we're broadcasting from London Bridge, and both Mark and I have been in this building today in lockdown. Now, I don't think we're going to be inappropriate. We're not going to say what we've seen today, but it's clear that there was a well-planned operation to protect this area. But what I wanted to ask you next about was this. Look, there has been a knife attack in the London Bridge area. This is the second one. And, you know, even though two people have been killed, clearly this has been a far less successful campaign, far less successful attack from the point of view of the terrorists. And that's because local people got involved and started to fight back. Is there an automatic process when people get used to these attacks that they will start thinking about and responding to them in perhaps a different way than they would have done had they never experienced them before?
Yeah, I think this is what I said. It just struck me of this is it, we're not having this anymore. And I think there is that sort of stoicism we're seeing amongst many of the public. I mean, the advice is to run, hide, tell. Well, we certainly didn't see run, hide, and tell. We saw them running towards the attacker and pin him down. A very brave thing to do, absolutely brave thing. And, you know, they wouldn't know if they saw that vest, was it real or not, and the police didn't know, and they took no chances on that, and that's why he was shot. Another brave decision to make.
Dr. Lowe, the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has praised members of the police, but also the public, for confronting this attacker. He talked about the heroism of Londoners. Does it concern you at all, though, members of the public getting involved in that way? I mean, clearly in this incident, on this occasion, it may well have saved a life or more. But what's your view on the public getting involved?
Well, I suppose I should give the party line of your best standing back and let the police deal with it. They're trained to deal with it. But I know if I was in that situation, even as I'm aging a little bit and not quite as young as I was, my gut reaction would be to go and deal with it, and I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. I think a lot of us are feeling that way, and I think what is also going to be beneficial is perhaps it will heighten vigilance. I mean, it's trying to get the balance right. We're coming up to Christmas. We're coming up to a great fun time now. I mean, a busy time as well. You know, there'll be the shopping, but there's Christmas parties coming up. You know, we're off to the theatre, take the children to the pantomime. I mean, I'm taking my 25-year-old. We still love it. You know, we'll still be doing things, but it's just increasing the vigilance. If you see someone who isn't behaving normally or trying to avoid CCTV or is acting furtively, we just report it. We'll be more vigilant, and by doing so, it'll keep us safe. And it doesn't matter if you got it wrong. The police will deal with it sensitively, but it's best to be safe than sorry.
Now, Dr. Lowe, finally, we've taken a lot of your time. We really appreciate your insight. There are obviously endless questions, but this person was armed with a knife, an enormous knife, if the footage that I've seen gives it any justice. And what's your view in terms of the gun laws? Because mercifully, this person was not in possession of a gun. Why do you suspect that a gun wasn't sought and that a knife was the weapon of choice? Is it a question of availability? And does this give us comfort in terms of our safety as citizens that someone like that couldn't get hold of a gun?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. I mean, one good thing that we have here is by having an unwritten constitution, we saw after Hungerford and then Dunblane, the government can very, very quickly introduce legislation which will restrict access to guns, and that's important. But that saying, we still have firearm trafficking coming into the UK for organised crime groups and for sale for terrorist organisations. But it's not that easy. It isn't just a case of going on the criminal's version of eBay and buying it. It's very, very difficult, and it's very, very hard to obtain these weapons. So that is one godsend. And then that also indicates to me this is not a person who's deeply imbued with an active cell who has that capability to obtain weapons. This is this is an educated guess, and I'm only surmising. I could be totally wrong here. This is an individual who looks as though he's been inspired by some extremist content and has just gone and got a knife and carried out an attack, because that's going to be hard to legislate against.
And that tells you, I guess, that the battleground in terms of a case like that is the hatred online, and that's another front on which this war is being fought. Dr. David Lowe, we cannot thank you enough for your time, your insight. We really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us on Talk Radio. Former counter-terrorist detective, now a lecturer in crime and security. We're going to examine this in much greater detail. We've also got updates for you. There's a lot of further speculation about who this person might have been. Reaction from the Met's Chief Commissioner Cressida Dick, full statement. We'll share that with you. Sadiq Khan, the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition. Easy to forget there's an election happening at the moment. There are implications for our election. I know, Andre, you want to know if we're going to start campaigning again or whether that has to stop for the foreseeable. So many issues to discuss. It's good to have your company. It is Talk Radio. It's Mark Dolan and Andre Walker with you through till 1 o'clock. Thanks for joining us.
The 21st Century Dream Team of dialogue, debate and discourse.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Yes, indeed. Mark Dolan and Andre Walker with you until 1 o'clock. And we're very sad to be covering such a tragic story for the nation. It's happened in London. It's not the first attack in London. But we know that obviously the prevalence of terrorism, whatever the context, and we're still trying to unravel that right now, aren't we, Andre, in terms of, you know, who this person might have been. Was there an organisation involved? Was this just, you know, online hatred stoked and brewed and fermented through the internet, or is this more of an organised, you know, platform and group?
And this is the thing that always gives so much problems for the police and the security services, because obviously there are assumptions made here by people like you and I, who are civilians, who don't understand things fully, who don't have the intelligence in front of us. But what has to happen is that the police have to get on with their job and go through a process, and that process is to first of all neutralise the suspect, but secondly to consider what other suspects might be involved, and thirdly to search the area, because, you know, even though the suspect is dead, there is still a police investigation ongoing tonight, and that will look at who he was involved with, whether he was inspired by other people, whether there is a danger of follow-up attacks. All of those things have to be properly looked at. And of course, it's always frustrating from our point of view to sit around for hours and hours and hours waiting for streets to reopen or the transport network to reopen. But of course, the police have to be absolutely dogged and absolutely clear in making sure that the investigation is as fulsome as it can possibly be. Because, hey, you know what we saw today, and this is where I'm incredibly proud of this country and where I'm incredibly proud of this community, is that what we saw was, after the last attack on London Bridge, a far more robust response than before. So every single one of these incidents, tragic as they are, is something that we learn from and something we become stronger as a result of, and something that protects our capital through that learning process, through that experience process, and through the intelligence we gather.
Well, that's right. This area did suffer an attack on the 3rd of June 2017, a brutal and shocking terrorist attack of, obviously on a grander scale. 8 people tragically died, 48 injured. And here we are again, 2 years later. I must say, humbled to report that we have with us on the line a witness from this afternoon's attack. And it's Dirk. And Dirk, I believe you were evacuated from Roast Restaurant, which is right in the beating heart of Borough Market, a bustling food market, a tourist attraction. Dirk, thank you for making the time to talk to us this evening on Talk Radio.
Good evening. How are you?
Yeah, I'm obviously we're all very, very, very sad and shocked at the news of what's happened in the capital city. Can I ask you what you were doing in Borough Market? I assume you're having a meal at Roast Restaurants.
So I was meeting a colleague at Roast Restaurant, and Roast Restaurant is quite famous for its social enterprise kind of activities and helping the community and giving back to the community. So it's a really vibrant place for people to come and meet for in that sector, and obviously also who enjoy Borough Market. And we were literally just there having a coffee, and all of a sudden we saw, you know, people just running past, and an elderly lady got completely run over and trampled on. Stalls got shattered, and it was pretty chaotic.
And you obviously at this point had no idea what was going on.
We had no idea. We were surprised. Like, half the restaurant was looking out the window, and the restaurant is on the second floor, so we were not at street level. Yeah. And everybody was shocked, and nobody knew what was going on. And then, you know, our first thought was what's going on Twitter. And then, you know, a minute later, 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, we saw the first kind of couple of pictures of what looked like another terrorist attack.
So you witnessed all of this, Dirk, from the second floor of the restaurant, and you were watching a stampede of members of the public from the second floor. And did you, I mean, for example, the bystander, did you see that lady recover? Because obviously that must have been an accident with the sheer volume of people trying to escape.
Absolutely. We did see, like, once she got knocked over, some people walked over her, literally just like scrambling for the exits. But eventually, 2 people came and helped her up and surrounded her and checked that she was okay. And, you know, whilst this was going on, we then already saw, some policemen, heavily armed policemen, already in Borough Market, and the stream of people running past just did not stop. We thought they must have been all gone now, but it took probably 10 minutes and people were still kind of running past, walking past quickly.
Dirk, one of the things that struck me about today, so I'm in a very similar position to you. I watched the evacuation of London Bridge Street once again from a first floor first floor location. What struck me was that, you know, the world is going about its business absolutely as normal, and then suddenly the police say move, and suddenly people move incredibly quickly. But actually, what I felt was that great sense of kind of being rooted to the floor. And you watch all these TV programs or films about people being brave at these moments, but actually what happens is you're incredibly scared and confused. Is that the way you felt?
I mean, we have been, like, my wife and I, we went to Paris a few years ago, and we were live in the terrorist attacks in Paris. We were literally on the Place.
This is the Bataclan incident.
Exactly. So for me, in many ways, it was like, oh my God, this is just like this thing again that I'm experiencing. So there was an intense kind of sense of calm inside of me, but I could see the people on the street and the people in the restaurant. Everybody was in shock and people scrambling, you know, around and like not knowing where to go and what to do.
Well, I noticed that when people started running, of course, remember, you know, I could
run.
I could see what was 10 foot behind somebody who was running, but obviously they can't see because they're at street level. And actually, the stampede happens really quite quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think like once one person gets scared and then, you know, multiply that by 5 by 10, every, you know, kind of mass hysteria sets in.
It was unbelievable because within seconds, and I'm talking about the front entrance to the News UK building, within seconds, suddenly there was a deluge of people who were, you know, absolutely desperate to get in. But it just happened so quickly. That was the thing that I was surprised by. And it just shows you how these terrorist incidents start quickly and in many respects end quickly. What happened on London Bridge was 3 or 4 minutes.
Absolutely. I was really surprised at how quick. I would say probably 7-8 minutes went past, and you could already see heavily armed police, like in Borough Markets, and it felt to me like the response time was extremely quick and extremely well coordinated. And I'd say after 15 minutes, Borough Market was completely cleared out. The rest, like Roast Restaurant, was full by that time, so a lot of people fled into the restaurant either because they knew it or either because the restaurant let people up. But the restaurant was full by that time, but Borough Market was empty.
Did you know the history of Borough Market in terms of the previous terror attack, Dirk?
Of course I do.
Yeah, and so therefore I would imagine the first few moments when you saw this panic, I guess something in the back of your head must have thought, here we go again.
It was definitely a deja vu experience, having followed it quite closely and having been very close to the other attack. Like I work in Elephant and Castle, so you know, London Bridge is just a stone's throw away essentially, and it just felt extremely intense, but still I felt relatively calm because I felt it was quite well handled by the authorities.
Did you speak to any other members of the public about what was happening while it was happening or shortly after?
Oh, absolutely. Like I was there with my colleague Martin. And we were literally there, sitting down, having coffee, and we were quite calm, still talking about what we came to talk about there. But then we also kind of talked about, oh, this is really interesting. This is happening right before the elections, and this is probably going to be playing in the hands of, you know, certain political parties if they want to use it that way.
Yeah, look, I think we can all agree. We hope that none of them do. Apart from condemning the incident, it should never, I agree with you, be political. So, yeah, but you realise that's right. The timing of it is extraordinary. They've chosen a part of London, haven't they, which is very high in terms of police presence already, because Andre and I are regular presenters on talk radio. We do a weekly show. Which we record on Friday afternoons. And also, I love this part of London, and I go to Borough Market with my family. And I did not let the last attack stop me.
No.
Because I've grown up in this city, and I grew up in the spectre of Irish terrorism. And you were in Paris in November 2015.
Absolutely,
and the scale of that was absolutely shocking. 130 people lost their lives.
Yeah.
Can I ask you how you're feeling tonight, and also what impact, you know, being in Paris had on you, and just how how do you fear for your mental health after witnessing a second attack? And we're really sorry that you've had to go through that.
I just went back there because my bike was stuck. So I just literally, I took the bus until Elephant Castle, then the bus stopped, and I walked the rest. I literally came back 10 minutes ago. And I recovered my bike from there. The police still had the actual bridge kind of sectioned off, but you could go all the way up to Borough Market again, essentially. I recovered my bike and I cycled back. I was, you know, I felt extremely calm. After having witnessed and having lived through Paris, this felt, you know, it didn't shock me in any way, shape or form for some reason. It was bizarre. I just, you know, picked up my bike, looked around, cycled back, and yeah.
Do you not think that, and I don't want to be critical of you, that perhaps it's a sad thought that you are now desensitized to this? It's a sad thought that you're accepting that this is a part of real life, and it's a sad thought that you see this as almost like a regular thing. I mean, you know, is that not a sad state of affairs for all of us to be in when there's somebody who comes on this show who has seen two terror attacks and actually, you know, it's not as shocking perhaps as it would be otherwise?
I think we have to see this in perspective. If you look at it in its totality, we're now living in the safest ever time period that this planet has ever seen. It's the fewest deaths in general, people dying of war crimes. We are living in the safest times ever. However, because of social media and media in general, incidents like this are obviously much, much, more broadcasted. But I do generally feel quite, safe in general. And I do feel, because I travel quite a lot for work and for other occasions, that the world has become a safer place, but there will be these incidents of extreme violence in certain localities. But we have to accept them as, as being what's happening around us at the moment. The world has tipped sometimes in favor of these terrorists who can hold, people and nations hostage due to their acts, basically.
I agree with you, Dirk. I don't think we can begin to have a league table of which Western cities are more safe than the others, because it can happen anywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Anywhere in the world that has liberal values, that's based upon freedom and tolerance, is something that a lot of these hateful ideologies are against. I would ask you, though, I think it's important that you get all the support you need, Dirk, because, you have witnessed this today, and I'm sure it's going to be very traumatic. So I hope you're able to access the support you need. In a couple of minutes' time, we're going to be speaking to a psychologist about the mental impact of this. However, one question, do you imagine you will change your behavior living in London? Are you going to stop visiting busy places? Are your habits going to change at all as a result of this?
I'll be back shopping at Borough Market tomorrow.
You're going to go back to Borough Market tomorrow?
Because it's incredible. If you're being held hostage by these things happening, then you're really giving in to fear, and you're giving in to, kind of these negative sentiments. And obviously for the businesses in Borough Market, it was shocking when it happened the last time around, and local businesses are the ones affected most by these incidents. And if we as the community and as the public are being scared to go back, they stand to lose, a lot. So I feel like the community back when the last attacks happened, they came back to Borough Market very quickly. And London generally, I think it's quite a resilient place, and people are not intimidated as easily and as quickly. So I do feel that, continuing to go back to these places is important. And as you said before, this can happen anytime, any day, in any part of the world these days.
This isn't so much a question as a comment based on what you've said. After we were finally let out of this building, I went to a sports bar that's just opened at London Bridge. And obviously on a Friday night, they would expect to be incredibly busy. Now, that is a new business that's opened 3 weeks ago. And of course, they've had an awful night as a result. And we've seen loads of examples of people who are unable to, earn the money that they need to do to make the wages that they need to make to go and look after their family. And I suppose we always talk about people who are the physical victims of this, but can we forget the economic victims as well?
We mustn't. I know, for example, on Borough Market, there's a really amazing social enterprise called Change Please, and they are working with homeless people as baristas. And I know if they don't get customers, then they will struggle as an organization to continue to trade and make the money that they need to pay the people that they're working with. So I think it is important to look at the wider kind of consequences and the wider impact that this has, and also what the individual can do about it.
Well, Dirk, you've inspired me. I'm going to go to Borough Market tomorrow, because actually we shouldn't let these guys win. Actually, we should be supporting these businesses. They're fantastic businesses. It's one of the best places to eat in the world. Borough Market is, of course, where Bridget Jones lived, if you remember the film.
That's so, right.
Dirk, at what point do we break it to Andre that Bridget Jones isn't real?
Oh God,
let's not spoil the illusion. Dirk, before I let you go, I wanted to say a couple of things, which is we really appreciate your time after the day you've had. I'm sure all you want to do is be with your wife, your partner, and just somehow gather yourself. But I wish you a lot of strength going forward. And you sound to me like a typical Londoner. And I say that because you have a gorgeous international accent, and you also have an attitude which is keep calm, carry on, and you'll be getting that coffee tomorrow morning. I think it's worth mentioning Change Please. I've just jumped on the internet and found it, and it's an excellent social enterprise. And have a look, actually, because they operate out of these vans, don't they? And they're using people who really could do with the work, serving up excellent barista coffee.
And that's like ChangeBase is one of the businesses that we have supported. So I run startup incubators and accelerators, and we specifically support small businesses, small charities, social enterprises. And it's so important for these small businesses to have the customers to keep on trading and to keep on making a difference. So anything that we can do to just go back and support them, I think it's incredibly important.
Well, I always think as a customer, as a consumer, the pound in our wallet, normally a bit more, £2.50 for a good latte, it has the power to make a lot of positive change. And I'm going to mention changeplease.org as an excellent, excellent website. Yeah. Have a look at that. And Dirk, thank you for your time. And I just wish you well. And thank you for educating us more detail about what happened today, and also for some remarkable personal insight, and you're handling it incredibly well. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good night to you.
Good night. Take care, Dirk. What an absolutely insightful conversation that was.
Well, just
Andre.
Well, the thing is about him, and this is one of the questions that I want to ask later on in the show about the idea of how much we keep calm and carry on, because clearly Dirk's view is, hey, let's get straight back. I mean, look, I think Dirk would have been drinking in Borough Market tonight had all the shops and restaurants and bars been open.
Yes.
And so I wanted to ask you later on about the impact on the general election, not in terms of the political parties.
Of course not.
Not in terms of the way people will vote, but in terms of the fact that all the parties are going to suspend campaigning to a greater or lesser extent. Maybe we should have the Blitz spirit. Maybe we should say the terrorists do not win, and we're not going to stop doing anything at all, and we're just going to be out in force tomorrow, as we would have been anyway.
Well, that's right. And So obviously, actually, as with any terror attack, it's an example of the very worst of human nature, a hateful ideology, appalling, unimaginable violence, but then also human courage, human endeavour, a collective human spirit in which people who didn't expect to be wrestling a terrorist to the ground and retrieving a knife from their iron grip, you know, and this is like suddenly that's how your day is panned out.
And what did we see earlier today that I pointed out to you when we were walking past? A security guard who's obviously been working so long, working so hard, in his uniform, asleep in the canteen, after the long day he's had protecting the building. And actually you think, wow, you know, a guy like that, it's not like he's knocked off work. He could have gone home. He could have decided he wasn't going to be bothered. But actually what he did was had 5 minutes sleep and then back into it. That is the greatness of this city, and that is the greatness of this country.
It is the United Kingdom, and I know that everybody listening feels that an attack in London is no different from an attack in Manchester.
Absolutely.
And we saw that at the Manchester Arena, and it could be Glasgow, and it could be any part of our country. And indeed, frankly, you know, globally, obviously, but, you know, any country that is a free liberal democracy, where we are entitled to live the lives we want to live and think the things we want to live. And of course, the hateful ideology that's prevalent online is more or less what's feeding a lot of this stuff.
But these guys are never going to win. I mean, I don't even agree with this whole, is it going to divide communities? We've never seen community division.
No.
Not in any meaningful sense. What we've actually seen is we've seen Londoners and indeed people from Manchester pull together. Actually, I shouldn't say two cities. We see people across the UK and indeed across the world pulling together and supporting each other. And you see, you know, when I watch that footage today, when I watch that footage today and I see six people sitting on top of a guy they believed had a bomb.
By the way, six members of the public. Because this person who is now deceased had a fake bomb strapped to his chest, obviously for maximum terror.
I know we're over time on the break, but the one final comment that I would make is this.
The break can always wait for you, Andre.
Not only were they sitting on top of him and trying to stop him, even though they thought he had a bomb attached to him, if you saw, the police had to drag one of the guys off the suspected terrorist. These people were so love their community so much and love this city so much.
But they didn't know that they were going to be embarked on this extraordinary
Not at all.
Moment. And, you know, 5 minutes previously, they're checking their Facebook status, reading a book, sipping a coffee, and then suddenly they're in the centre of a global incident.
It all happened so quickly. I saw it for the first time today when I saw the evacuation. It happened so quickly. It's from completely normal London Bridge being what it is. Boom. The next minute, everything changes.
Well, we hear the fight or flight response, and we're going to talk about that with our next guest,
Absolutely.
Who's a top psychologist, in terms of you don't know what your brain is going to tell you to do, but we saw a lot more fight than flight today.
We did.
This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
You're listening to Talk Radio, Mark Dolan and Andre Walker, on a tragic and appalling day for the whole of the United Kingdom, an attack in London Bridge that has led to, I'm afraid, two deaths and three seriously injured people, one of whom is in a critical but stable condition. The second person who's injured is in a stable condition, and thankfully and mercifully the third member of the public, worth reminding yourself, an innocent civilian who has injuries but less significant. And we will keep you obviously updated with all of that. We're going to have a look at the psychological side of it now, not only for those survivors, witnesses, bystanders, but actually for any citizen that wonders whether they're really safe to walk the streets of London or indeed other great cities in the United Kingdom. Let's speak to Honey Lancaster-James, who is a psychologist, a friend of Talk Radio, a regular with Matthew Wright, a woman that's in demand, always on Talk Radio for her expertise and insight. Honey, on this very sad occasion, welcome to Talk Radio.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Yes, it's a difficult day, isn't it? But I think whenever these kind of events occur, I always say we can sort of focus on the negative. This can be a story about villains and about tragedy, and of course it is, and my thoughts and feelings really do go out to the victims and their families and their loved ones tonight. But I think we also need to take this opportunity, I think, to share that message as well, that we have also seen the very best of people today as well, and you were talking about that earlier, and how people can be so heroic and so brave at times of adversity, and I think we also want to understand more about that as well. And so there's a lot, I think, for us to process collectively as a community.
Well, I agree, honey. I mean, the focus always at that moment is, you know, whether you're in a situation like that or if you're reading about it and we're talking about it on the radio, naturally we're thinking about casualties. We want to know how many people have lost their lives, how many people are injured, what those injuries are. We only think later about the psychological impact, the mental scars. Yeah. And if somebody has survived with an injury and eventually physically recovers, what is the legacy for an individual like that going forward in the long term? Can you ever completely move on as a human being if you survive something as appalling as this?
Well, I mean, I think certainly no one's going to forget the events of today, particularly people who were involved in it and, you know, or witnessed it firsthand. But one of the things that we know psychologically is that the meaning, our understanding of events and the meaning that we attribute to them and our memories of events are very, very much affected by the narrative, the kind of story that we tell ourselves about those events, both at the time but also later on. So we know that the way human memory works is it isn't a sort of a flash bulb. You know, we don't take a photograph of the events and record them as they are. We actually, our memories are reconstructive. So sometime down the line, our memories will be affected by everything that we hear about those events as well. And for people involved today, whether they were witnesses, whether they were very close to events, or even if you're just in the locality, or you're just watching it on the news or hearing about it on the radio now, we will all be affected by it. But the way that we'll be affected will be very unique to each one of us, and it will be dependent on what we tell ourselves. I mean, I live in, as you know, I live very local.
Yes, you do.
In London Bridge. I live in this area. I work in this area. It's very dear to me. And I was here 2 years ago with the other London Bridge terror attacks. Mm. And I was actually very sort of very narrowly missed out on being involved there. I'd actually been having a meal with my daughter just an hour before in the market, in the pub where it all happened. So it was very, very disturbing, very unsettling. And one of the things I realized then was that my memory of that and how that affected me was going to be dependent on how I chose to look at those events. And I could focus on the threat, on the danger, and the very tragic, tragic loss of life and those difficult things. But that is what terrorists want us to do, of course. But I could also focus on all the amazing acts of courage and bravery that I saw from the emergency services, how well they organized everything, how thorough they were. And I actually came away from that event feeling safer than ever in London as a resident around here, knowing, you know, I even had an experience where this was 2 years ago, where I happened to be coming out of my apartment and I had a gun pointed at me. At that time, I didn't know what was going on and I was very scared. But of course, later I realized they were trying to protect me. They were trying to get me to go back into the building where I would be safe. And so a lot of the time, the impact that these things have on us is about the meaning that we attribute to them. And so just in terms of sort of advice today on these most recent tragic events, I would say that it depends on what you focus on. You can look at this as an act of terror. We can be very aware of the threat, of the danger, or we can say, actually, there are millions and millions and millions of people who live in London, who work in London, who travel through London, and the vast majority of them are good, law-abiding citizens, and look what we've seen. We've seen them jumping to help one another, and even putting themselves at risk.
But honey, we just heard from a guy called Dirk, who, you know, is incredibly stoic, he wants to go back to London Bridge tomorrow. What about the people listening to this show, and there will be some of them that actually don't feel brave in the face of terrorism, who actually are afraid to go back to London Bridge? You know, should they feel like they're cowardly, or is there some answer that can be given to them about the way they feel and why they feel differently to Dirk?
Yes, no, not at all. This isn't that's not a cowardly response at all. It's actually a very normal, natural human response. We are hardwired to respond to perceived threat in a very dramatic and very quick way. Everything in our nervous system and our brain is geared towards keeping us safe. And so it's a perfectly normal, natural response to feel afraid, to want to run away from danger. These are all very self-protective mechanisms that we have and nothing to be ashamed of there at all. And of course, our experiences are very dependent on previous experiences in life as well.
Okay, now, honey, let me interrupt you there. I know that it's late, but if we could hang on to you after the news, because I think we could really use your insight. Would that be okay?
Of course. Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Yes, no problem.
That's awesome. More analysis and more breaking news, all the information you need on this very tragic day, an attack in London. This is Talk Radio.
Current affairs with Voltage.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
It is indeed Talk Radio, Mark Dolan and Andre Walker on a very, very sad day, a tragic incident in London Bridge in the capital. Two people killed, three more civilians, members of the public, injured in a terrorist attack near London Bridge. The suspect was wrestled to the ground by passers-by and shot dead by officers, possibly, Andre, motivated by the fact that this person, who is now deceased, was wearing a fake suicide belt.
Yes, and in reality, what does that tell you about the individual concerned? That they are somebody who has set out to harangue and alarm and upset ordinary people going about their ordinary business and attempting to, you know, just maybe go to work, to pay the bills, to, you know, take their family out for lunch, to maybe get some very early, possibly too early, Christmas shopping in. I have no respect or sympathy for that sort of a person, and that what I do have is an enormous amount of respect for the police and the security services that we've seen today. You know, to see hundreds of police officers out in force, the way that they took control of the situation. We heard from Dirk earlier talking about the fact that he reckoned that Borough Market, from the start of the incident to it being fully evacuated and secured, was 15 minutes. And bear in mind, the attack was not in Borough Market. You know, that is a remarkable achievement.
It is indeed, and you're right to identify Dirk, who is an eyewitness that we spoke to earlier in the show. We are going to keep you updated on all developments right through until 1 o'clock. Martin Kellner is taking over at one, and we are pretty much handing ourselves over to a sort of 24/7 rolling news service. We are at your service here to give you all the information you need, not just the information, because luckily things have obviously calmed down in the area now.
Yes.
Our building is still cordoned off. I can't retrieve my motorbike to get home because I'd have to get past a line of coppers to do that. So, you know, the area is under lockdown, but the bottom line is that it seems that for the moment the drama is over. But we are looking into how this happened, who this person might have been, and we'll look further into the analysis of this, and also how exactly the authorities will go about trying to make us feel more safe. And speaking of feeling safe, and that's a key word, we'll finish our conversation with psychologist Honey Lancaster James. Honey, thanks for sticking around at this late hour.
Oh, no problem.
I just wanted to ask you whether as citizens, any great, you know, city in the Western world, you just never know when or where there might be an attack. Do you think as a public we should just ignore thinking in that way and more or less just get on with our lives? Do you think that is the approach? What is the correct set of mental tools for all of us? You know, do we just lock ourselves at home in fear of what might happen, or should we just identify that life is dangerous and crack on?
Well, I don't think it's an either or answer, really. I think it's a combination. We have to accept that there are threats in the world. There is risk, but there are risks to lots of things. There are risks to crossing the streets. There are risks to, you know, doing almost anything, actually. There's a risk if you don't do anything and you just sit still as well. So that is something we have to make our peace with, and we have to learn to live anyway with risk, alongside risk. And I think one of the things that we do need to do is educate ourselves as to sort of what to do to keep ourselves safe in certain situations if they unfold. But then there's also about realistic measurement of that risk and putting things into perspective. And I was saying earlier, you know, we live in a city, London, but other cities as well, where there are millions of people, good law-abiding citizens, going about their business and actually all very well-meaning. And unfortunately, it takes just one person with whatever motivation to behave in a way that hits the national and world news. And of course, that is what everybody talks about. And the problem can be that psychologically, that can sometimes inflate our sense of what the actual risk to us is. And I think we also have to look at what's being reported today and look at even the events as they unfolded in a measured way as well. Because yes, we saw an attack, and yes, very, very sadly and tragically, two people have died and three people have been injured. But what we also saw was that members of the public who were just minding their own business leapt to help others, rushed in, ran towards danger in some cases. I'm not necessarily saying that's advisable to do, but I'm saying this is what some human beings do. So in the same way that we can look around and say, okay, there might be some human beings out there with malintent, what we should also take comfort from that is to know that actually many human beings will rush to our defence and our aid and our help as well. And it's not just the emergency services who we've also seen act in very, very brave ways as well. So I think we need to live alongside both those realities, that there is risk and there is threat, but actually there are things we can do to protect ourselves, to safeguard ourselves, and it isn't always the right thing to run towards danger. You know, it is important that you think about whether you are vulnerable, and I believe the police advice actually is to run and hide and then alert the authorities. But of course, there will always be people who will also leap to people's defence in a very automatic way as well.
Well, I guess, you know, this is a very helpful, and it's great to have your insight, that the bottom line is that, A, statistically, these things, you know, are still rare, and that ultimately, as human beings, we're probably equipped with the correct set of emotions and impulses to make ourselves, well, certainly act on impulse and often do the right thing. It's been wonderful to have your insight. Honey, thank you for making the time, and I hope we hear you and your dulcet tones on Talk Radio again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much indeed. Brilliant to hear there from Honey Lancaster Jones, giving real insight into the human and psychological aspect of an attack like this. Now, meanwhile, Andre, yes. Because it's 24/7, it's news, it's talk radio, there is an election happening. Campaigning has been paused since about, you know, mid-afternoon, around 2:30 when the news broke, all campaigning stopped. We had statements from the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn. However, the BBC had their debate, and that went on. And in fact, the members of that panel all commented on this appalling attack in London Bridge. The actual show itself, which I caught some of, the optics of it, it looked like a really disappointing episode of 15 to 1. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Game show.
Yes, I
presented
did.
By William G. Stewart.
Oh, I don't remember who presented it.
But it was, of course, run by the BBC. It was a second division, a second tier of available political talent, because it wasn't the leaders.
Be careful.
Well, it wasn't Jeremy Corbyn, it wasn't Boris Johnson. However, Jo Swinson deigned to appear, as did Nicola Sturgeon, Richard Tice from the Brexit Party, Rebecca Long Bailey. Then we had Rishi Sunak, Chief Secretary to the Treasury for the Tories, who I had to Google. A couple of people had to look up. Caroline Lucas, who we know is the Green Party, and Adam Price from Plaid Cymru. Okay, so anyhow, let's take a little bit of political insight and find out who might have been the winners of that debate. John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator for The Independent. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hello there.
John, we've obviously, you know, been dominated our agenda tonight on what's happened in London Bridge, this awful, tragic terrorist attack that's claimed two lives, injured three others. Did the politicians tonight comment?
Yes, they started off with that. I mean, presumably the BBC must have had a hurried debate as to whether to go ahead with the programme at all. They obviously decided that they should, and that was reflected later with Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn saying that the election campaigning would continue tomorrow, which I think is the right response. You don't want to sort of stop democracy just because of the actions of some malign individual. But there was quite a somber start to the debate, and I thought Rebecca Long Bailey, as Jeremy Corbyn's deputy on the programme, gave quite a sort of prime ministerial and sombre response to the tragedy.
Yeah.
The other politicians were a bit more just sort of they noticed it and then moved on. But she performed very well.
It's always a difficult question, isn't it? I remember reading about the Queen Mother when she did the tours of bomb sites during the Second World War, as to whether it was crass and offensive for kind of anybody in a leadership role to be seen around. Obviously, these sorts of visits now are incredibly common. How easy is it for politicians to judge this right? Because there is a line between keeping going and carrying on, or being seen to be aloof, and also there's a difference between wanting to refer to an incident without being seen to politicise it, or worse still, use it to try and garner votes.
Yes, no, I think that is absolutely right. And to be fair, I don't think any of the politicians tonight did do that. They didn't cross that line. I mean, it's interesting to reflect, though, on the last election campaign when there was that terrible Manchester arena bombing in the middle of it, and you know Jeremy Corbyn did actually address that and make a political issue of it and turn it round. And in fact, there was the other London Bridge incident, which is actually just quite close to this one, that also happened during the election campaign. And Jeremy Corbyn managed to turn that round to make the case against police cuts against Theresa May, rather surprisingly. Managed to gain some political advantage from it. But, you know, I mean, obviously tonight was much too early to start a political debate about terrorism and security in our streets.
Well, there was always that very, very sensitive and delicate moment, and it's almost, I almost find it hard to properly explain it because it feels so delicate, about the murder of Joe Cox during the referendum on leaving the European Union, and the concern that the referendum was going to be about the murder of Joe Cox, and exactly, you know, where is that line? Because, you know, people feel a connection between the election and terrorism, inevitably. I mean, if you're talking about police numbers or international policy, but at the same time, the idea that when two people are dead, one person is critically injured, or in the case of Joe Cox, a member of parliament has been murdered, the idea that you would be seen to be politicising that, it would be death for any politician.
Yes, and quite rightly. I mean, people have to behave with the appropriate dignity. You know, to be fair, I think all the politicians in the debate tonight, I mean, I think it was the right decision to go ahead with it. I think they treated it with the seriousness it deserved, but they carried on with a political argument, because I mean we are in the middle of an election campaign, and you know democracy must must go on, and the best answer to the terrorist, in a way, is to carry on with democratic debate.
So how about the politics of tonight, John, moving on from today's tragic events? Were there any points scored in particular? Did you see any winners or losers emerge? Or was it all lacking something given the absence of Corbyn and Johnson?
Yeah, well, it was very much so. I mean, it was, the seven-way debate is pretty odd to start with. I mean, it's too many people. And the only reason it sort of worked in the last election campaign was because Jeremy Corbyn turned up at the last minute and Theresa May didn't turn up. She sent Amber Rudd instead. So there was that drama of, you know, one of the main party leaders being there and taking on the other party leaders sort of second in command.
Yeah. By the way, was Michael Gove in the car park, or did Boris Johnson's dad, was he sort of hanging around in the canteen?
To get in. No, I don't think there was anybody complaining they hadn't been let in. But this was a rather strange format because, I mean, in a way it appeared to be the sort of future leaders debate. I mean, it was two sort of rising stars in the Labour and Conservative Party. Rishi Sunak is not exactly a household name, but I mean, Rebecca Long Bailey is quite well known, and she's sort of well known as one of the sort of favoured successors for Jeremy Corbyn. And she performed well, and so did Rishi Sunak, to be fair, but he was much more programmed, much more on message, definitely stuck to his brief, sounded like a talking Tory press release, really.
Do you know something, John? I genuinely love the "I agree with Nick" debate between Gordon Brown, David Cameron and Nick Clegg. But I've never seen anything subsequently that suggests to me that these leadership debates are anything other than just a bit of vanity. Does anybody, you know, is anybody really learning anything from this? Or is it just a piece of theatre that the media companies are determined to have? And also, you know, have any of them lived up to the heady days of the "I agree with Nick" thing?
No, well, possibly not. I mean, but the thing is, this is set up to be seven party leaders, including Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. So, if they had both been in it, I think it would have been more interesting. Although the sort of Johnson Corbyn head to head debate that we had 10 days ago, that was quite hard to watch because it was sort of scratchy and difficult, and neither of them could ever finish their points. And you know, the audience didn't really help. Whereas, as you say, you know, the 2010 three-way with Gordon Brown, David Cameron, and Nick Clegg, that was, you know, because there were three of them during the campaign. They were big events, and they were big theatre.
John, before we let you go, and thank you for joining us and giving us this assessment and overview of the debate tonight. And I think it is, you know, in a wider sense, important that we do keep talking about the election even today, because this is our political discourse. This is how we do things in a free liberal democracy. I'm going to ask you for some predictions, but I'm going to walk the walk, John. Now, all of your answers are filtered through this sort of deep well of knowledge and experience. Mine is conjecture and instinct. I'm going to predict that Boris Johnson will be grilled by Andrew Neil. I just cannot see a way around it for him. And I think that the Conservatives will win with a majority of three. That is my live prediction on Talk Radio. Andre Walker, will Boris Johnson face Andrew Neil? And what will the result of the election be? By the way, this changes every day, John. For me, it's the same thing. It's like, what's your favourite Beatles song? Every day is a different answer. So, today.
The election campaign is moving all the time.
Well, exactly.
So you're responding to new information.
Exactly. At 23:19. So that's what I'm calling it, a three-seat majority.
But Mark, here's the problem that you've got with this. You know, conservative strategists, and look, I worked in the House of Commons for a conservative MP, so I was absolutely low level, bottom range.
You were Margaret Thatcher's bag carrier.
It was. But it's very easy to say that Boris Johnson is in a stick position, but Remember, that is what they told Theresa May, and things went horribly wrong as a result.
Will he yield to the BBC and be interviewed by Andrew?
The tough Andrew Neil, not Mark. Well, here is...
It's very hard to get a straight answer
out of you. I'm being a politician now. No, I'm not. Look, here is the big problem. We are not in... Elections now are data-driven, and we are not in receipt of the data that they're in receipt of. What these guys are doing, people like Dominic Cummings, are looking at numbers every single day. If they can get away with not speaking to Andrew Neil, they will do that, but they're going to know long before us.
It's a bit like proroguing Parliament. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, sort of thing, and they'll stop at nothing to win. And what do you think the result will be of the election at this moment?
Oh, Conservative majority 30.
Okay, and finally, John, will the Prime Minister yield and face Andrew Neil? And what's your prediction at this moment of the chances of or any majority for any party?
Well, I agree with Andre. I think they will try not to be interviewed by Andrew Neil. If the pressure is too great, if Boris Johnson decides he's going to lose more by dodging it, then they will agree to it. But I think his aim is to avoid that, and it just depends on how it plays in the media and in the opinion polls. As for the result of the election, I think there's a very wide range of possibilities, but I think the most likely is a substantial Conservative majority.
John, we won't hold you to that because we know it's events, dear boys. Events, dear boy. And also that a week is a long time, let alone a day. So, John, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your wonderful overview. Chief political commentator for The Independent. And what this man doesn't know about politics is not worth knowing. Thanks very much for your time. I tell you, there is one person that Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn and Joe Swinson and the Plaid Cymru guy truly live in fear of. And do you know who that is?
Me.
No. Julia Hartley Brewer.
Oh, come on. I thought it was me.
At Talk Radio Breakfast, brought to you with the Times. Oh, know your Times.
You are sucking up. You know what's happened? Ian Lee's away, and so Mark Dolan is sucking up as hard as possible. You know what? What you need to do is remove your nose from wherever you have just shoved it.
You're listening to The Election Station.
The 21st Century Dream Team of dialogue, debate and discourse.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
It's Mark Dolan and Andre Walker on Talk Radio, and we are broadcasting live from London Bridge, which is, a dark coincidence after the attacks today that has seen a would-be terrorist gunned down by the police very swiftly with the assistance of the great British public, the London public, several members of the public. I mean, if you describe, if you've got the internet, if you've got a smartphone, you've probably seen the footage. I wouldn't recommend you watch the footage if you are of a delicate disposition, because it's quite something and very typical of our modern age that you now get to witness this kind of attack live on your smartphone.
But it's been an extremely unusual day for you and I, because obviously we came in here to record Mark Dolan's fake news that goes out 10 o'clock tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And obviously we've ended up locked in the building and basically witnessing this. And so the hard thing for me is to rationalise out to what extent are we here to talk about and comment on and be reporters or journalists or talk show hosts, or whatever it is, and to what extent are we witnesses, and to what extent are we kind of victims in the wild either sense.
And also, here's the other thing, is that back in the day, our grandparents' generation, our great-grandparents' generation, who, by the way, we think of every Remembrance Sunday, and that's why we wear the poppy. I wear it with pride.
Yes.
Because we're thinking about those in a different era of political and military history in which countries were at war with each other. It was very black and white. Germany invades Poland. That, you know, breaks a sacred treaty that we had with Poland. We then declare war on Germany, and it's very, you could explain it to a 5-year-old.
That's right.
The Second World War. It's very simple. Even in some ways, the Gulf War and the Second Gulf War and Saddam's activities, you know, but the bottom line is now it's a different kind of war. And the difference is that we don't have soldiers that we send abroad who do the fighting for us, because in a sense, without being too dramatic or melodramatic, somehow as citizens, we're all foot soldiers in this.
Well, you know, sometimes they say that in things like this, there are no heroes, only victims. Well, actually, today, I think that we were proved wrong on that. I think there were some heroes. Can I just read out something that I saw on Twitter, which is, I don't know if you know, I was involved in the City of London, and what people can see, the posh grey building that they can see on the footage is actually Fishmongers Hall, the Worshipful Company of Fishmongers. Yep. And a lady has tweeted, I won't give her name, even though she's on Twitter, because I don't know whether that's appropriate.
Right.
A guy who was with us at Fishmongers Hall took a 5-inch narwhal tusk from the wall and went out to confront the attacker. You can see him standing over the man with what looks like a white pole in the video. We were trying to help victims inside, but that man is a hero. Can you imagine this? You are in Fishmongers Hall behind 3 feet of solid stone wall, and what you do is you pull... I mean, I don't know what a narwhal tusk is, but I've got to be honest with you, during the terrorist attack, it's not something I would arm myself with, but he's taken something off the wall and gone out to help. What an unbelievable example.
Well, at... 5 minutes past midnight tonight, we're going to be talking to a former SAS trooper whose job it is to handle situations like this, who is trained at the highest level to attack and, you know, disarm somebody that, you know, means harm on the rest of us. But we are somehow all inculcated in this if we are the victims of an attack. So let's speak to another expert before we come to Phil. And it is a top counter-terrorism specialist, a man with more knowledge about this subject in his fingernail than we do, unfortunately, because he has an expert insight into this. Simon Trundle, welcome to Talk Radio.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us on this very sad and tragic day. Can I ask for your reaction to the events? Where were you when you heard what was going on, and what were you doing?
I was on a work call speaking to a client who had recently asked for procedures and assistance in helping to deal with an attack on the premises, and they needed the ability to be able to lock down the premises. And believe it or not, we had completed the project some few months ago, and we were just reviewing it in a conversation when all of this started. And they are actually located very close to London Bridge, so they invoked their plans, immediately locked the building down and kept all of their staff in a place of safety. So it was amazing timing.
Are you able to elaborate on the advice you were giving on that occasion?
Well, on that occasion, the building entrance was typical of many modern design office buildings. You walk in and there's a reception desk with staff on the public side, and then you have some low level, you know, typically glass barriers. You walk over, you swipe your card, and you walk through the barriers. But in this instance, they were unhappy because the barriers were so low that you could merely jump over them. And if you did, you were then next to their main staff restaurant, which could at times have 400 people in it. So they decided to change their reception area, increase the screen height, and have some emergency lockdown on the doors. And I won't be able to say who it is, but you know, they know that the actions that they took a few months ago were of use today.
I was, I think I was pretty shocked and stunned when I saw the level of organisation that went into the security of the building that we're in. Because obviously I was fairly blasé. You walk in, you swipe your card, there's a few people on reception. Obviously they're big lads, but then a whole procedure swung into action. You know, how much planning do major companies put into this sort of thing?
After the attack on Borough Market, and it's interesting, it's 30 months since then, and it's using exactly the same tactics of a bladed weapon and a fake suicide vest. After the Borough Market attack, quite a few premises in that immediate area came, and we spoke to them and we helped them. And some said, well, fine, we'll just close the front door, but others went to the extent, and I know the building you're in, they went to the extent of actually training their staff and applying additional mag locks and electronic locks to doors, so at the press of a red button in the security control room, they can secure their perimeter of the building, secure the inner perimeter of the building, and staff have refuge rooms to withdraw to. So it's, but you only get there if you recognise the strength of your building, what you can do with it, and if you train your staff.
But, Simon, if you think about the Second World War, when bombs were dropping on London, you know, it was very much seen as the job of the state. It was very much seen as the job of the RAF or the military to protect these buildings. You know, maybe it's unfair to I know you're not doing this, but if you were to be critical of companies that aren't spending a fortune on this sort of security, you know, why is it down to them to do that? Shouldn't this be a function that the police or the government step into?
No, it's simply the scale of the problem and the scale of the potential target area. So we don't know where it could happen. This could have happened this evening in Oxford Circus. It could have happened somewhere else in the city. There are so many potential targets that you would not be able to have enough police. And then those police would need to be armed, as you saw today, to be able to respond effectively. So it is just the message out there is we're in this together. You need to consider whether you can lock down your building and keep your people safe. I mean, for years we've been advising on internal shelter areas and refuge rooms. When the IRA were letting off bombs, people said, well, you know, we need to keep our staff safe. So the government security agencies developed a shelter-in-place policy, and then businesses said, well, actually, no, we have a duty of care to our employees, and we want our employees to be happy to work in a city, and we want to show them that we're investing in their safety. So they invested in it. Yes, ideally, none of us would ever have to consider these things, but nowadays, in this world, in this crazy world we're in, we just have to be as diligent as possible. It doesn't take a huge amount of money. It takes more to do with training and more to do to make sure that if you do have procedures, that they are effective procedures.
Yes. I mean, ultimately, what's a bigger threat? An organized attack from a well-funded platform like, IS, Al-Qaeda, previously the IRA, or an individual that has a weapon and has internet access who has most likely been groomed into a hateful ideology, which is, you know, as a counter-terrorism specialist, which is the greater headache in terms of how you protect the public?
Certainly the latter, the lone individual, because if people are planning major events, major incidents, and they're trying to fabricate explosives and get a team together to carry out a spectacular similar to what the IRA did, that leaves a lot of forensic trails. It leaves a lot of potential instances where you can actually pick up their movements and deflect the attack before it happens. The greatest threat we face now is the lone individual, a clean skin. They have no criminal record. They are not on the radar. They are sitting there at home being radicalized, and they decide to act. Some people have said today this individual was a former prisoner. Yes, but even if we try to track and trace everybody on the watch list, we would need vastly more resources. And you have to carry out a risk assessment. The risk assessment says we need to keep an eye on the main players, do our best, and be able to respond quickly. So the efforts of the police have been to have a faster deployment of the armed firearms teams, so that if an event starts, it can be shut down as quickly as possible. And as you saw today, the public helped in that, and then the police arrived on scene.
But isn't one of the big difficulties that any policing service or any intelligence service has is that, you can track because of visits to various websites or whatever, who are the hate-filled extremist bad people. But then what you've got to do is take that total list and work out which ones of them dream of attacking the country and which ones are actually going to do it. And so when we hear about this known to the police or on a terror watch list, what happens quite often is that they were known to be hateful, they were known to be extremists, but there was an assessment in the end, a wrong assessment, that they were somebody who would never really act on whatever it was that they were dreaming of.
Yes, and we have this contest program as well, where we're trying to capture people in the early stages of radicalization and re-educate them. It's been successful for some young people. It hasn't been successful for others. It hasn't been successful for diehards. But if we look at a list of 800 persons of interest, including many hundreds who returned from Syria, in order to effectively surveil somebody, and if people say, we want these people followed every day, we want every one of their movements covered, we want to know their internet use, we want to know where they shop, where they hang out, who they meet, then, you know, we'll end up with a phenomenal amount of security resources going into 800 people, which we just simply don't have. We don't have the trained staff. It takes over 100 person team to follow one active target successfully, and that's all the team, that's all the analysts and the people on the street and everything else. And if you have 800, I mean, it beggars belief as to how many we need. So that you have to play, I don't mean play the game, but you do have to do a risk assessment. And the JTAC group, each month, sit down and work out what is the risk to the nation, what's the risk from individuals, and they deploy the resources as best they can.
But couldn't you? I mean, I remember it became fashionable a few years ago, this concept of zero tolerance in policing, where what you would do is you would stop people from, you know, minor offences, and you would crack down on that because you decided that people who were regular rule breakers were also the people who were dealing drugs or whatever. You know, why aren't we making sure that even the most minor offence of logging onto a jihadi website or logging onto a IRA website or dealing or fundraising for whomever, why aren't we cracking down on those minor things? And so fundamentally, the people that we do not like, who we're concerned about, are going to court regularly. Admittedly, it might only be for a month or two in prison or a fine, but, you know, we're taking the fight to them.
I think that would change your entire society. And also, bear in mind that a response like that is exactly what they want. They want the security services now to start, and the security force and the police and everybody else to start grabbing as many people as possible, because it gives them a wider pool then to say, look what's happening. They're persecuting our people. Now, I worked in counterterrorism in Northern Ireland. Not surprised with the accent. I saw it firsthand. I suffer from it. But the greatest recruiting tool over there was a hard-handed policing program.
But isn't there another side to that, to say that don't I, as a member of the public, have a right to say, hey, you know, I don't care what these people think of a heavy-handed police approach. I want the law enforced, and if people are offended by that, they can take a hike.
Yes, you can say that, and despite all the politicians' promises about what they're going to do with the police services, it costs money, so people say, right, I'm willing to pay a penny extra in my income tax, you can spend it on the police force. Then we will have a lot more resources, believe it or not. It is about available resources, and the police have been stretched for years. And Cressida Dick this evening, you know, I'm surprised she didn't say we are doing the best we can with the resources. She said we're doing the best we can. But can I just emphasize before we forget it? The public always have a role. The public are the ones who will hear the conversation in a cafe, who will be suspicious of something happening around a garage lockup unit. And in the past, ordinary members of the public phoning in have actually deterred, have led to disruption of terrorist planning. We've had people storing explosives in lockups, going back to check them. That was reported as suspicious activity. Security services were able to swap out the explosives and leave them with an inert substance, and then track their movements and completely disrupt what was going to be a major bombing campaign against Blue Water Shopping Centre or another similar crowded place target.
There's also I think you're absolutely right, and you're right to mention the Troubles, of course. And, you know, Andre and I'm a little older than Andre, but I grew up, you know, very much, you know, with very clear memories about the Troubles and how as, you know, as a Londoner, that there was always that threat, and felt like sometimes every other day there was a car bomb in Northern Ireland on mainland Britain. And it was something that entered the culture, and the British people, you know, both sides of the border throughout the UK, just became quite sage about terrorism. And obviously it's tragic and it's appalling, but there was very much a sense, among the public of life goes on, and we've seen that again today, haven't we, Simon? And as you say, ultimately we are somehow coming back to, you know, the intro to this conversation, we are to a degree, as members of the public, foot soldiers in this battle.
Yes, because the people who are attacking us are not directly confronting the police. They're going for unarmed civilians. They're going for men, women and children. You've got to look at the ideology that inspires somebody to take a knife and go out, and it shows them the seven ways of you know, we had the court case the other day where the lad had the knives, and he had a document on him saying the seven areas on the body to stab in order to kill. And we had the conviction of the man who attacked the people in Manchester. Just the ideology is that they don't care who you are, what age you are, if they can kill you, if they can maim you, that's the sole goal. Wearing a fake suicide vest is either for two reasons. One, to assure martyrdom, because you're going to get shot and killed. Or the second is to allow continued movement, because people will not want to come towards them. So therefore, the attacker can gain more and more momentum, involve more and more people. So it's the ideology behind this. The IRA, I would never say anything good about them, but one thing was they wanted to go home and have their tea. So they tended to leave a bomb out in the opening, give a warning. They were not gentlemen. They were murderers. They were terrorists like everybody else. But we're dealing with a different tactic now. At a moment's notice, something could develop in front of you. And we just have to accept the best thing we can do is get ourselves out of the area. If you're immediately able to help detain somebody like happened today, that will be the exception. It will not be the rule. That will be the very rare exception. And the people today who did it, more power to them, you know, very brave of them, very good of them.
Policymakers have a dilemma, don't they? And thank you, Simon. We will wrap this conversation up, and we appreciate it's been a very long day for you. So thank you for your time. A lot's been done already. Concrete barriers have been erected in lots of major cities, pedestrianised areas, which obviously would be a bit of a soft target for a would-be terrorist. We've seen, you know, all sorts of barriers on bridges. Do you not feel, though, as a society, that we're rather sort of yielding to the terrorists with these great eyesores and these extra levels of security? And there's such a focus on, you know, protecting us from an inevitable attack rather than looking at the source of it, all that online hatred, and focusing on a more digital approach rather than physical barriers.
Yes, there are more than one front. There's more than one front in the battle. The barriers, if the barriers hadn't been put up, and we had a repeat of the London Bridge vehicle ramming attack, if we had a repeat of Westminster, people would then say, why didn't you put barriers up? But at the same time, there are many different levels. There's the intelligence game to play. There's the online detection, and then there's the physical security. And just today, a police officer did not wake up this morning intending to shoot somebody dead. He did his duty. He couldn't take any chances for the greater public.
No, but there is the thin end of the wedge, isn't there, in terms of us giving in a sense, to the terrorists, the threat, because obviously it's fear that they want to evoke in all of us. That's their currency. And they can do it with a hire car, a truck, a gun, a knife, any weapon of choice, really, which is, you know, is a very, very troubling thought. But do you not think that this is the thin end of the wedge when we just accept that we live in this landscape now? You know, do we not risk sort of the Trumpian attitude to an attack in a school, which is to arm the teachers? You know, is that not where we're going as a society, by accepting rather than rejecting this danger?
I think we need to reject the danger. Our politicians need to stand with the people. The people need to be able to speak out. And the communities from which these people draw what they claim to be their inspiration or their identity, they have to speak out. So if it was in the time of the IRA bombing, we, you know, spoke out against what they were doing as fellow Irish citizens. In this instance, it needs everybody involved in it. Sadly, we're going to face this reality for the foreseeable future, whether it's another 5, 10 years. Mm. And I just plug one thing. There's a free app from the government, Citizens Aid app. If you download it on your mobile phone, it gives you a very simple to follow app, teach you how to deal with people who are bleeding, deal with people who are injured, what to do in a terrorist attack, etc. It's well worth having on your phone and studying. So it's called the Citizens Aid app, developed by the government, freely available, and it's a help and a reassurance to people.
Well, I've just downloaded it onto my phone, Citizen Aid. It's a free app available on Android and on the App Store for an iPhone user. We will definitely do that. And do you have a social media profile or a website where people can further tap into your expertise, Simon?
I can be found if they go looking for me, but I don't tend to be on advertising my wares. It's not about trying to create business, but if anybody needs to speak to me, they can find me if they do a search online.
Yeah, very good. Simon, we really want to thank you so much for your time. It's very late. It's been a long day, but I've certainly learned an awful lot listening to you tonight. So thanks for joining us on Talk Radio.
You can find me, but I don't advertise. He's the real deal, isn't he?
He is.
He's the real thing.
Proper James Bond.
Absolute real thing.
Simon, maximum respect, sir, and keep up the brilliant work you do as well. And thanks for recommending that app, which I shall repeat the details of after this break.
Join the Talk Nation.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
It's Mark Dolan and Andre Walker with you until 1 o'clock, after which Martin Kellner will take up the helm and entertain you through the evening. The potential for entertainment is limited today after a terror attack in London, which is an attack on the nation. I think we can all agree on that. And so Fleet Street agree as well, because we've got the front pages in front of us. The Guardian, 2 killed in London bridge terror attack. Suspect also injured several others before he was shot dead by police. Officers say perpetrator was wearing fake explosive vest when apprehended. Members of the public hailed for their bravery in disarming the attacker. The Sun newspaper, 2 hours after London horror, heroes of the bridge have a go, 6 grab bomber. That is 6 citizens. You've got to remind yourself, Andre Walker, over and over again, just members of the public going about their business.
Well, you know, I had a very good friend of mine who sent me a text message earlier pointing out that there is the George Cross, which is given out for bravery for ordinary citizens, and it is the highest bravery award. By the way, I mean, I've just been sent the photo of the narwhal tusk, which sounds comical.
Could you recap what the context is for that?
So essentially, there was a chap, and he hasn't been named on Twitter, but people have talked about him.
I think it's narwhal, by the way.
Narwhal. Okay, yeah. So I don't know what this is. I've never heard of this thing in my life. And I said it was 6 inches. It's 6 feet long.
Okay.
And so what he did was, he was in Fishmongers Hall. So there's something called the Worship Company of Fishmongers. Mm. That is the grey classical building you can see in the background from all the videos that you've seen online.
Because there's a great culinary heritage in this area. Borough Market is one of the original Victorian markets.
That's
as well,
right.
It's steeped in sort of, you know, gastronomic history, this area.
Absolutely. Although the Fishmongers Hall is slightly different, because each of the traditional trades of the City of London will have their own club, if you like. Mm. So this is for the fishmongers. Well, anyway, they had this.
Oh, I see. Is it like their social club?
It is their social
club.
Yeah.
I see. I thought it's where it was historically where you got you in and got your pound of herring.
This is. I mean, these places are unbelievably posh, because obviously they've been going for hundreds of years and built up artwork. Anyway,
you're a member of a lot of clubs, aren't you? You're quite well connected.
I am. I'm a member of the City University Club, which is a great City of London institution. I was the Deputy Master Young Freeman of the City of London. I ran for council in the City of London a number of times and lost badly. I might join a livery company. Of course, our boss, Mr. Murdoch, is a liveryman.
Great man.
At the Worshipful Company. Oh, fantastic guy. Great guy. Believe me, great guy. He's a liveryman at the Worshipful Company of Stationers, which is the group for journalists. Anyway, this tusk is 6 feet long.
Right. And tell us what's the allegation that this guy's
in Fishmongers Hall and he sees that the terrorist attack is going on.
See, I was confused, because I thought he's just sort of descaled a salmon and he put his, you know, oyster knife down. And no, this was a private members club sort of thing for the industry.
Yeah, so this is effectively.
And he's torn. What, an artifact off the wall?
An artifact off the wall, which is a 6 foot long tusk.
I don't wish to, I'm seriously, would never be sort of, you know, offer any light-hearted tone to this.
Oh, it sounds.
Actually, in a sense, this is a human experience, and they're alongside the evil and the sheer, you know, dark forces that have led to this appalling attack. But then there is a human spirit, but there is also that, you know, do you remember the last attack in London Bridge 2 years ago? And one of the iconic images, which I found very British, was lots of people running, and one guy running, but with his pint in his hand.
Oh, Mark, look, I don't want to be inappropriate, but I heard a story from a former member of parliament who had been in the Brighton bomb when the Grand Hotel in Brighton was blown up in, I think, 84, something like that.
Yeah.
And Margaret Thatcher was almost
Conservative
killed.
Party conference.
Yeah. And essentially, he said he came down because the bar goes all night, and it was something like 3:30 in the morning, and kaboom, the bomb goes off. And he said, of course, what happened was the ceiling went, and obviously there's just dust in the air everywhere. And he said there was a bloke, everyone was under the table, and this one bloke came up from under the table, picked up his pint, there was a lump of the ceiling in the pint, he scooped it out, sat down and continued drinking. And the police are going, "Sir, you're going to have to, I'm just going to finish my beer." but actually, I think there is a great thing about this country where people are a little bit like that. I mean, look, I don't want to laugh about this, but you know, there is fundamentally a piece of great British eccentric genius in the fact that somebody was sat in his private members club and decided to take a 6-foot tusk off the wall and attack the terrorist with it.
Well, it is, you know, it is another aspect of that, the more human side of this story and the fact that people come together. I don't want to sound like a Disney movie, like a Spielberg sort of, you know, yarn, but I do, and I tell this to my kids, that there is evil in the world, but yes, there is more good than evil, that good will always win, and we see it time and time again.
Well, of course, the other thing is, if you were to be a millionaire fishmonger, then you would probably know how strong this tusk was, and so whilst to us it sounds comical, actually this bloke probably knew that this thing was the thing to use.
I mean, I've got to say, Rudyard, our esteemed executive producer on the show, he's been worried that he didn't know whether we could corroborate this story about this.
Oh, no, it's definitely true. There's photos
tusk,
of it.
This tusk. He thinks you might have dreamt it when you were having your afternoon nap.
But no, it's definitely
it
true.
It is a true. Well, it's an extraordinary thing. And so there we are. And we are where we are. There's obviously going to be a huge amount of work done in the area. Much of the central London, and I don't want to make this a London-centric story, but I feel that an attack on London is the same as an attack on any city.
But if you think back, so I'm a Mancunian, if you think back to the Ariana Grande situation, the attack on the Manchester Arena, one of the things that was incredibly frustrating for me was the way the arena themselves, so just to explain the geography, because people might not know, the arena itself was part of the redevelopment of Manchester Victoria train station. So the arena is above the train station, and what happened was security protocols only appeared to apply to the arena and not to the station itself.
Yeah.
And so that was something that was learnt from that attack, and I think if there was ever an attempt to attack Manchester Arena again, God forbid, you know, the security services and the personnel on the ground would be much more wise to that. I think what we saw today, much as it's horrendous, look, you know, was a huge difference to what we saw 30 months ago with the first London Bridge attack. Yeah. You know, people much more coordinated, people much more organised. Buildings like ours, and once again, we said at the outset, we're not going to describe what we saw in terms of the security response from this building, but we heard from Simon Trundle that he'd advised companies right across London Bridge. You know, it's night and day. People do learn from these attacks, even though they're horrendous.
And, you know, this perpetrator who was gunned down, I think died instantly. Well, he chose the wrong part of London to attack, because not only the legacy of the last attack means that there's a huge infrastructure in the area. That's just ready. We're looking at minutes and seconds in terms of available combat from armed police.
Yeah.
And that's what happened today. I mean, Cressida Dick can be very proud of her policy and the work of her men and women under her who acted so swiftly.
Oh, these police have been phenomenal. But I wanted to ask you a question right from the outset, just very quickly. Would you, had you been in charge of the BBC, cancelled tonight's leaders
debate? I'd bring back Balls of Steel. And I'd make myself presenter again, even though I've aged quite noticeably.
Would you have cancelled the leaders debate tonight?
And,
if you were a political party leader, would you have suspended campaigning tomorrow? I've got to be honest with you, I wouldn't have. I believe we should follow the example of Dirk from earlier in the show, who witnessed the attack today, who's going back to London Borough, going back to Borough Market tomorrow. I think we need to stick two fingers up at the terrorists and keep going.
Yes, I do. And I think that the values that have been attacked today are the values of that leader's debate, which is our democracy.
Absolutely.
And the fact that, you know, and here at Talk Radio, we are offering a 24/7 balanced assessment of what's happening in the election. But what we want everybody to do on December the 12th is get out there and use their vote.
And of course,
whoever they vote for.
One other point to make, because we are in London Bridge, Talk Radio did not go off the air for 1 minute. Talk Sport did not go off the air. Talk Sport 2, Virgin, none of the newspapers stopped. The fact was that whilst the city was under attack, people up and down the city in this area and outside of this area kept doing what they were doing, and that is where we win.
Well, that's right. And of course, the papers, and you know, we're part of News UK, and the Times, the Sun are going to offer an extraordinary amount of insight into what happened yesterday. And our colleagues, we know, because we're in the same building, have been working non-stop.
Absolutely.
And that photograph on the front page of the Sun today is extraordinary. Heroes of the bridge. And I think that's exactly the right sentiment. And that's the biggest story. And it's a story about the indomitability of the human spirit. Much more analysis, expert guests, and more or less Andre and I disagreeing. This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Well, we're in our last hour. Mark Dolan and Andre Walker with you until 1 a.m, at which point Martin Kellner takes the reins. And we are bringing you all of the latest on a terror attack in central London, in London Bridge, the second attack in as many years in the capital, in that area. Two people tragically killed, three injured. The details are that one person is in a critical but stable condition, the other person is in a stable condition, and the third member of the public that was injured has non-life-threatening injuries, mercifully. So we will give you more information as we have it. Lots of statements coming, and of course the Prime Minister has spoken, the Leader of the Opposition. So far, I'm pleased to say, no one has attempted to make political capital out of it. And I hope that that doesn't happen, because I see this as a wider issue. It's cross-party. It's an attack on British soil, you know, no different to any other of that hue. Cressida Dick, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, has spoken. She said, "I'm deeply saddened and angered that our city has again been targeted by terrorism. It's with the heaviest of hearts that I must inform you that, as well as the suspect who was shot dead by police, two of those injured in this attack have tragically lost their lives." She goes on to say her heart goes out to their loved ones and to the three further injured victims. The attack started at Fishmongers Hall in the City of London, which Andre mentioned earlier. She said, "My understanding is that police were called at just before 2 p.m. and City of London police officers had bravely and professionally confronted the suspect by 2:03. So we're looking at, to be precise, 1:58 is when the call was received. At 2:03, they're at the scene. That's 5 minutes. That's an extraordinary achievement. She says, "If you are concerned about anyone who was there today, please try to contact them. If you cannot, then get in touch with the Met Police." She obviously goes on to thank the emergency service personnel and members of the public, and she's right to do that. In the coming days, she says, you'll see more police, both armed and unarmed, patrolling our streets to help reassure those who are understandably concerned. Similarly, she says, our counter-terrorism detectives will be working round the clock to identify those who have lost their lives, to support all the victims and families, and working full tilt, and this is the important bit, to understand exactly what has happened and whether anyone else was involved. Let's speak to a man who has really walked the walk in terms of facing danger on our behalf in the name of freedom and our collective safety as a society. Former SAS trooper Phil Campion joins us. Phil, thank you for making the time. We appreciate you joining us on Talk Radio.
That's right, buddy. I've always got time for you.
Well, thank you, Phil. We really do appreciate it. And, I'm always humbled when I'm, you know, when I meet a soldier, I speak to somebody that's been in the SAS like you, the very elite of the military establishment. First of all, where were you when you heard this news? What were you doing? What was your reaction?
I was driving back from, I had half a dinner engagement last night, and I was only driving back from Lincoln.
Right.
When I heard about this today, yeah.
What did you think? I mean, was there a sense of a sort of weary acknowledgement that this was just a matter of time and that we'll be having this conversation again in the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been cited as saying publicly before that this thing isn't over yet. You know, it's not going away straight away. And, you know, for the want of some very brave men and women, this would have happened a long time ago and lots more of it. And they're keeping the lid on it. You know, we've had one slip through the net today, and it's been dealt with in an extremely professional way. And I must say, you know, for trained people to run into a situation like this is one thing. The people who are untrained, these civilians, who just, you know, the six of them who just dived on top of this geezer. He's obviously, you know, up to no good. Absolute extreme heroism on another level. You know, they really have done themselves proud and this city proud. And, you know, everyone involved today has sent out a massive message, as far as I'm concerned, is to say, we won't have that in this town. We're not having that in this town.
How much?
You can come, you know, everybody's had a go at this town over the years, from, you know, from the Nazis onwards, have tried to bomb this town and have their way here, and you're not having it.
How much planning do the security services and the army and the police put into a day like today? Because things seem to work like clockwork. As Mark was saying a second ago, you are talking about the 999 call being received and the terrorist being dead 5 minutes later. I mean, that to me sounds absolutely extraordinary. You know, is this something that is constantly being secretly rehearsed for?
Yeah, this is round the clock stuff. This isn't sort of like just ad hoc, oh, we just happen to be in the right place at the right time. They're ready for these people. They really are. You know, this is not by coincidence that this has happened in 5 minutes. They've planned for this. They're ready for this. And when it's happened, they've pulled it off exactly how they trained for it. And they've done an absolutely exemplary job today. And shown the whole world what we are capable as a force again.
I mean, look, as a professional soldier, you have your own opinions on serving around the world and indeed serving the country. You know, how much different does it feel for the war to be fought on our own streets? Is that something that affects people that are in the military and the security services?
No, the target's a target to me. I don't care where it pops up. It really is.
That's a typically militaristic view on things. But look, you know, in terms of, I've got a very good friend of mine who's a Coldstream guard, and it always strikes me that what he was saying was, the difference between somebody like you and somebody like me is that all the training you've been through prepares you for the kind of shock, which probably in your case isn't shock, of being confronted with this sort of thing. You know, I felt so bad today about freezing. You know, is that something that you would ever worry about in this situation?
No, I've analysed these sorts of situations before, and you know there is a fight or flight element in everybody. So if somebody does freeze, that's their reaction to it. That's the way life is. You'll get men that run towards, and you'll get men that run away, and that's the way it is. There's nothing you'll do about that. You know, and you know, I don't advocate have a go, heroes, as I don't advocate not having a go if you feel you have to. Do you know what I mean? So it's horses for courses on that one, I'm afraid.
I mean, this is the ultimate dilemma, Phil, as a trained professional and the very elite as a former SAS trooper. What's your advice to a member of the public if they are walking down the street and they witness what they think is a terrorist that's about to launch an attack? I mean, what do you do? Is there, can you go, you know, preloaded with an idea of how you'd handle it? Or should you just sort of more or less go about your life and the natural instinct will kick in one way or the other?
I think, if I'm perfectly honest, that you can prepare for these sorts of things. You know, you can carry certain pieces of equipment. You can be prepared. You know, a lot of people do carry these, what we call EDCs now, everyday carries, where they've got tourniquets and that on them permanently and all that sort of stuff.
It doesn't, really?
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's quite a big thing, believe it or not. I can't really advise one way or another to the normal person on the street. I can show them techniques, I can show them this, I can show them that, I can show them the other.
Mm.
You know, but at the end of the day, like you say, it will go very much down to the day of the race, when the balloon goes up, how you actually react as an individual. And you won't know that until you're actually in that situation.
So, I suppose, do you think there's a judgment? Because what we've got here on the front page of the national newspapers, including the Sun newspaper with a very vivid shot, is that in the end, even if it's not a trained professional like you, 6 or 7 or 8 people who can work together, the judgment then is, well, there's more of us than them. And you somehow fancy your chances, and I guess that's what happened today, would you
absolutely,
say?
Absolutely. Look, these people have stepped in. They've stepped into an extremely dangerous situation. But if that guy had had a vest on, and he had have tacked himself off, they'd have died anyway. They'd have melted with everybody else as that bomb went off. So in that respect, you look at him and you go, well, you might as well go towards him and see if you can take him down, because if you're running away, you're just going to die tired.
Yeah.
You know, so you these people have done themselves extremely proud, does us all extremely proud, and they've showed these maniacs who want to come and do this on our streets that we ain't having it. We are not having this. You know what I mean? There are people in this country, both trained and untrained, from all walks of life, that if you want to go and set about people in this country, you better be prepared for the outcome. Because the outcome is going to ultimately be what happened today. You're going to be switched off permanently.
Well, Phil, here's a question.
Exactly, there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
For the cost of a couple of quid, which is what these bullets have cost, there's been no court case, there's been no court hearing, there's been no lengthy trial. The guy's been switched off and put in the right place. That mortgage, well, wherever he
I have to be neutral about the election, but I'm going to stick my neck out and say I agree with you on that one, 100%. Here's the thing, Phil. What I would ask you is, obviously, you have counterintelligence. You have armed cops, who, by the way, totally came through today. But are you saying that the greatest weapon we have is the British public? Are we at that point now?
Look. This town, London as a whole, we've had the IRA here, we've had the Nazis here, we've now got these lunatics here, okay? People stick up for themselves in this town, and that in itself is a defence capability, whether you like it or not, okay? We have got trained professionals, they do an incredible job, and long will they continue to
But they won't always be there.
They can't be in all places at all times, but they showed up pretty quick today, didn't they?
One of the questions I've got is an issue of experience. And, you know, I've mentioned it to some other people during this show. I've always said, and forgive me, Phil, if I'm wrong, that after what happened on 9/11, it would be pretty difficult to hijack a plane because now the 300 or 400 passengers know what you plan to do with the plane, and therefore the smart move is to attempt to overpower you. Because ultimately, if you're just going to fly the plane into a building, you die either way. I just wonder to what extent was the heroism today experience of knowing what these people would do, had already done at London Bridge 30 months ago. And actually, if you allow them to run amok, they're not going to take hostages. They're just going to run behind you and stab you in the back.
I think there'll be an element of that, surely. You know, people, you know, you look at case history in law, and that's why you have case history. So you can study what's happened before, because it affects behaviour now. So it's exactly the same with this. Things have happened before which put people in a different mindset. They know that if they see some maniac with a vest on, yelling and screaming and sticking knives into people, that he's likely to just carry on until someone stops him. And it could be them next anyway. So I think there is a bit of that mentality, yeah. I think people have decided, well, I tell you what, I've had enough of this. I'm going for this. I mean, anyway, we might die anyway.
It's amazing, because what that is then is the fear becomes actually potentially your strongest weapon, because you stand there and you say, well, look, I've now been given no choice. You know, there isn't a scenario here where I can just run off, or that you will, if I say please don't, you're going to actually behave in a merciful manner. I either slot you myself, or somebody else is going to do it.
But that's why terrorism ultimately will never work, because people are not going to have that. We're not going to be bullied. We're not going to be shoved. We're not going to be pushed. We're not taking that anymore. You know, it has literally got to that point where people are going, I'll tell you what, I'll jump in there. I'll save the day.
Sorry to interrupt you, Phil. If these lone wolf attacks continue, and we've spoken to more than one expert today, including Simon Trundle, counter-terrorism specialist, who said that really the biggest threat is not organised groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and formerly the IRA, but actually an individual who's been radicalised online, inculcated in a hateful doctrine, and who has a weapon. That's more or less all you need. And of course, we know that weapon could be anything, could be a hire car, could be a knife, any number of potential ways to hurt the public, right? But do you think that perhaps we as citizens could do with a better education? If we're in this war, do we need the tools with which to fight it? And by that, I mean, I don't know, kids at school, should they be taught a little combat? You know, should we bring back, you know, military, you know, conscription, military service for 16-year-olds? I don't know. Do you think we need to ramp up our preparation as a society for this context?
There is an old saying, and there is an old saying that a little bit of knowledge can be too dangerous.
Right.
You know what I mean? You give people a little bit of knowledge, it can be dangerous, all right? What you're seeing today is people that have reacted off the cuff and just gone for it, okay? If you don't start giving people choices and training, but not training them all the way, you could end up in a lot of trouble with that. You know, you could have people half going in, you could have people... I don't think we're at that stage yet.
We don't need to be in that same depth.
No, you wind up like, do you remember that character Gareth from The Office? Do you remember that? He was a sort of territorial army.
Hilarious.
Mark, I'll tell you that there was an incident, I think in Wolverhampton, where there was a chap on a coach and he attempted to reinstall I don't know what it's called, but the liquid that you put in your vaping machine. Sorry, I don't vape, so if I'm using the language wrongly, I apologise. And somebody thought it was some sort of liquid bomb.
E-liquid?
Yeah. So it was an e-cigarette. He was attempting to load the liquid in. Somebody decided on the coach that it was a liquid bomb, and he was beaten up and thrown off the coach. So it is true to say that these things can sometimes go wrong. And you know, you can imagine somebody going, I saw that and knew it was definitely some sort of liquid thing. But I suppose it is dangerous. But can I ask you, Phil, in terms of how the risks have changed? Because I've met people who've been in the SAS before, and obviously that is a role that constantly changes, and there's always an element of protecting us from overseas and protecting us within the UK. Has that changed significantly since we've moved from perhaps the more organised terrorist groups like the IRA into this much more social media-driven, one-off, lone lunatic-type territory?
Yeah, you're right. You summed up with this. I don't like the word lone, because they're not alone. They've been indoctrinated. They've actually learned their skills online, and they've been corralled and cajoled and turned into this monster by other people. They're not lone wolves. They don't just decide this stuff on their own. They read online. Okay, that's the key thing here. They aren't doing this on their own. They're not lone, all right? So there is other people having an impact on their lives, no matter what you say.
In fact, they're quite the opposite of lone, aren't they, Phil? Because they have been groomed over months and years.
Absolutely, they've been groomed. Absolutely, and they've been sort of like, whether they sort of like wanted to go to the program or not, they've actually been pushed and force-fed into the program to the stage where they've actually been, the pin's been pulled on them, and they've set themselves off in the way they have. So lone is probably the wrong word for me. But yes, there is this different modus operandi where people are prepared to jump in a car, load it with bricks and drive over as many people as they can, or they're prepared to, you know, just come out thrashing about with the biggest knife they can find until they're literally taken out of the game. So yeah, that it's an extremely dangerous scenario. I think all you can do is look at the case histories, you know, be aware of your surroundings. And if you're that worried, try and take some sort of precautions. You know, maybe look at the way you plan your day. Look at this or that. But like I say, that still won't stop this one-off, could be anywhere, anytime, thing from happening. And like I say, you won't know how you'll react until it actually happens to you.
Phil, before we let you go, and we're deeply grateful for your time, thank you for sharing your knowledge with us, which is a unique knowledge as a former SAS trooper yourself. A friend of mine is a police officer quite high up who said, if you knew how many attacks that are thwarted in cities like London on an almost daily basis, you'd never go, you know, onto Oxford Street or into Manchester city centre ever again if you knew. Would you agree with that? The fact that there's an astonishing amount of terror that the authorities see off at the pass. And should we, if we're preparing for a landscape that carries this threat, should we change our behaviour? Should I take my kids into central London?
Yeah, I'd tip that statement completely on its head and say that if you knew how good our security forces were, the UK is the safest place on earth.
Right.
Okay, because they are thwarting these attacks. If they weren't thwarting them, I'd say, right, stay out of town, because our security forces are bungling everything they do. Yeah. But they're not. They're absolutely on top of their game, and when a push comes to a shove like today, they have shown once again that they can deal with that threat within seconds, minutes. Do you know what I mean? They're there, bang, it's gone. It's dead. The guy was actually flat-packed on the spot. Do you know what I mean? So they've nipped it in the bud absolutely within minutes of it happening. So I would tip that statement on its head and say, yes, there are plenty of subversive people in this town, and there's plenty of people trying to upset the apple cart. But we've got just as many people, just as many brave men and women who are keeping the lid on things. And this town is a safe town as far as I'm concerned. And they're doing an absolutely cracking job. So it wouldn't discourage me at all.
No. Phil, how long were you in the SAS?
About five years.
Amazing. And, what made you, because, I mean, could you give our listeners a sense of the level that you've got to achieve to be in the SAS? I mean, just give it, for those that don't know, I mean, everyone's heard of the SAS. It's world famous. But just how many hoops have you got to jump through? How good have you got to be to get in?
You have to go on a selection process. I mean, I'm not at liberty to say too much about it.
Yeah.
You need to go through a selection process, which
predominantly would start off with about 300 people and whittle down to, you know,
a handful.
Single or even, you know, a handful of people at the end of it. So,
and Phil, you have to be, you have to be a soldier to even be one of those 300, don't you?
Yeah, you need to be serving in some capacity. You know, you need to be, you know, you need to have an army number, you need to, or a military number. The regiment recruits from across the board in the military, not just the army. You could be in the Navy and join the SAS if you wanted to.
And looking back on that time, that extraordinary time, is it a sense of satisfaction that you did that and you achieved that for your country and for yourself?
Yeah, I had a great time there. It's what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't do as much as some. I did more than others. So, you know,
5 years is not bad. I'm extremely
happy with what I did.
We'd all struggle to do 5 minutes, let alone 5 years. Are you able to tell us where you were in the world at any moment in time?
I can give you, I suppose, West Africa,
right.
Balkans.
Well,
here in the UK more than once. So, yeah.
It's extraordinary. And have you now, are you able to deploy that skill set since you've retired? Are you still in the military or are you in a lot of business now?
I was on the private military circuit for about 15 years, which meant I went to Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, Africa, Far East, Middle East, you name anything with an East in it, I was there, do you know what I mean? So,
really?
Yeah.
In what capacity, Phil? What, when you say that private, in a private capacity, what would you mean by that? Is that like sort of personal protection and things like that?
I've done protection, I've done training jobs, I've done all sorts of stuff. Yeah, I've done a fair amount of, you know, all I'll say for credible sources, you know, I've never sort of like jumped on the dark side, so.
Well, a friend of mine is a fellow former SAS trooper, and he was mugged in the street about a year ago. So a couple of people on a moped tried to grab his mobile phone. They didn't know he was ex-SAS, and let's just say he fulsomely disarmed them until the police got there, and they really picked the wrong man. And he must be I'd say he's in his mid-70s now, but once you've got it, you never lose it, do you, Phil?
I like to think not, you know what I mean? You've got to treat every situation with the same caution as you treat every situation in your life. But, you know, I'd like to think I could look after myself. But,
you definitely can. And I think it's as much the brain as the brawn by the sounds of it, Phil. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate it. It's very late and I'm sure you've had a long day. So thanks for joining us on Talk Radio. And I hope we cross paths again in the future.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Right,
wonderful input from Phil Campion there. Andre, the format of the show is we would normally throw to a quick break. But can we just reflect on people like Phil Campion?
Can I tell you something?
The courage and the endeavour.
No, that's not the thing that struck me about him. It was his unapologetic language. Mm. The guy has now been flat-pecked. Right?
Yes, I mean, it's a new verb that I may begin to use in my own life.
I've got to be honest with you.
It works for a lot of things.
He sees the world in terms of, and I don't disagree with him, he sees the world in terms of, look, these are bad people, and I mean, he's now gone where he belongs. You know, and actually, I think sometimes we are too apologetic. And too, not weak on these things, but sometimes there are sensitivities that exist in our mind that shouldn't fundamentally exist. You know, this was a man who, if he'd got away with it, would have killed 10, 20, 50 people if he'd been able to. And we've seen that sort of terror attack before. I think he's a reprehensible individual, but Phil, I think, is a great guy. Of course, what they don't tell you about the SAS is that it's a voluntary organisation, effectively. So you have to be in the military in order to join it. So when he's saying, oh, there's 300 people to start with, but it goes down to 300 people who are already in the military having
not
passed.
Just that. They're not some corporal junior.
Yeah, this is not Mr. Sweetchuck from Police Academy. You know, these are Leslie Barbara.
You're showing your age there. That's one for the teenagers. Well, it's lovely. The more you talk to people who have so much knowledge about the dangers that we face as a society and it's their job, it's their career to confront that. But what we've seen today is that members of the public have been, you know, confronted with it, and they've also stood up, and we salute them too. You are, by the way, very welcome to interact with the show. We are on Twitter, at Talk Radio. I'm at Mr. Mark Dolan. What's your Twitter handle? I know you're very popular on social media.
Andre, which is A-N-D-R-E, J-P Walker.
That's excellent. That's the Twitter handle to have. We will talk more about this. We also have the front pages. We have the first editions. We'll have a look at what else is happening. We might talk a bit of politics, Andre, but you've got to be balanced. So I think the way we'll achieve that.
It's probably best not to.
Well, what I'll do, I've got some gaffer tape here. I'm not afraid to use it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look,
if you're not balanced, I'm going to flat pack you.
Well, it almost feels like we're obliged to talk about politics because it feels like we shouldn't concentrate too much on this. And I do worry sometimes that what these people fundamentally want, which is a bit of publicity, we supply to them. But then there's a balance because people want to know what has taken place today.
Well, and this is with the great dilemma. I was discussing it earlier with Simon Trundle, which is that balancing act between the state stepping in and protecting us, but then having the visible architecture of terror on the streets, you know, and it's like big slabs of concrete in front of every pedestrianised area and barriers on bridges which are unsightly. Now, of course, I don't care if it makes us safe, then go for it. But, you know, somehow it is a visible sign that the terrorists are influencing our lives.
Absolutely. But what Phil Campion said, and I thought he had a brilliant comment in response to your, if you only knew how many terrorist attacks they foiled, then he kind of goes, yeah, they foil so many terrorist attacks because they're the best security services in the world. That's why I'm not worried about walking around the streets. Great answer.
It is a great answer. More great answers after this.
Current Affairs with Voltage.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
So it's Talk Radio. Martin Kellner after 1 o'clock. Penny Smith back tomorrow morning with Weekend Breakfast. And we will keep you updated on this huge story, a terror attack on British soil. That's the only way it can be described, Andre. And I believe you've got a bit of an update for us.
Yeah, this is some breaking news from the Press Association. We've heard rumours about this earlier in the day, but we didn't think it was responsible to report it until it was absolutely confirmed. I'll read this to you. London Bridge killer was ex-prisoner released with electronic tag. The knife-wielding terrorist who killed two people before being shot dead by police had reportedly been released from prison last year and had links to an Islamist terror group. The attacker, who was wearing a fake suicide vest and has not been named, was killed on London Bridge on Friday afternoon in full view of horrified onlookers. That was, that's the PA version. Also, the BBC, I think, have confirmed this, and what they have said is that he was recently released from prison for terrorist offences, and I think the other detail that's come out is that dozens of people were in attendance at an event at Fishmongers Hall, including students from Cambridge University and former prisoners. And I think essentially what is becoming clear now is that there was an attack effectively outside Fishmongers Hall, and then the individual concerned, as I say, out on licence, wearing a tag as a result of being convicted of terrorist offences, was then in some way pursued or tackled on London Bridge, not very far onto London Bridge, because if you see any of the photos, you can see Fishmongers Hall quite clearly behind.
Well, listen, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, maybe there's a case to answer there, that the authorities knew about this person and alleged links to Islamist terror groups. But if you were to ask the police, like if you ask them for a figure, a number of how many people that they track who have an online engagement with Islamist, you know, hate groups, forums, there would be thousands. Well, you'd have to lock everyone up and throw away the key. But it's not how our country works.
But see, I know a little bit about this because my family are Northern Irish Catholics, and obviously there was always a degree of suspicion to any law-abiding Northern Irish Catholic during the Troubles. And the issue that you have, and particularly when you're talking about that community, you have to decide which people are Irish Republicans and which people are Irish Republican terrorists. And that, of course, is quite different. Now, look, I don't have any time whatsoever for Islamic fascists or Islamists or jihadis or whatever.
Glad you got that out there.
But, you know, there is a big difference between somebody who's got unsavoury views, who has taken a religious view and poisoned it with hatred, and somebody who has distasteful views and plans to kill you as a result of those distasteful views. One of those is very different to the other. And the problem the security services constantly have is that when they get the lists of people who are going on these crazy terrorist websites, they have to decide which of them plan to become terrorists and which of them are sad, pathetic dreamers who are sat in their mum's bedroom, you know, imagining themselves to be some sort of hero of some sort of twisted terror campaign.
And we have the rule of law and we have a judicial process.
Of course we do.
And what you can't do is round anybody up that's gone on one of these websites and engaged with that material, because otherwise, well, I mean, there just aren't enough prisons.
Well, it was said earlier on the show that you know, that we made mistakes in Northern Ireland, and one of them was internment, where we simply it's now illegal, it wasn't at the time, illegally rounded up people and simply stuck them in prison. Well, they became universities of terrorism.
Of course.
And then, of course,
people became, I mean, they hadn't necessarily died, but they were martyrs whilst in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the other danger that you always have is this issue of a community looking as if it's being attacked. And by the way, remember, there will be plenty of people listening to this show who are Muslim, who are going to be concerned about some sort of reprisals for an attack they had nothing to do with and condemn as much. And remember, in each of these terror attacks, I don't know about today because I don't know about the victims today, but it's very, very common for people from all walks of life, every creed, colour and every religion, to be attacked. I mean, fundamentally, you know...
Well, because if you're attacked in Britain, then we live in a multicultural society.
Well, that's absolutely right. And somehow, I object to the idea that my Muslim friends should in any way apologise or feel bad for the fact that this crank has run round with a knife.
Well, just as, and my parents are Irish Roman Catholics from the Republic.
Okay.
They came over to the UK in the late 1950s.
Yes.
And I must say that, you know, in the 70s, I was born in 1974, throughout the 70s and the 80s was the height of, you know, Republican terrorism, the IRA, and of course Unionist terrorists as well. And I never felt judged as a member of an Irish family by my British fellow citizens. I went to school, you know, in North London, and I obviously we grew up in London, right? It's a great city. And I never felt, there was never any verbal abuse. There was never any prejudice. And you might argue that perhaps some people would have every right to be prejudiced, thinking, oh, wait a minute, you're Irish and look at what the IRA are doing. But I never felt that.
When you say you never felt any discrimination in North London, was it Kilburn? Because if I'm being totally honest, look, my family, when they came over from Belfast, moved to Liverpool. If your family moved to Kilburn, then in reality, look, I don't want
an outpost, isn't it?
I don't want to be critical of our multicultural society, but I will say one thing. The Irish government.
Where's that dump button?
Okay, the Irish government has a passport office, an Irish passport office in Kilburn, right? That is the extent to which it is quite an enclave.
Well, that's it. But, I mean, I think in the end...
But I take your point.
In the end, there was no... I don't know what you would call Irish phobia, but I never really felt judged as... And, you know, we were very overtly Irish family, and I've just never felt anything.
Sorry, just to be clear, what is an overtly Irish family? Do you run around with a shillelagh playing the Dubliners?
Listen, I can do with Irish parents. I'm allowed to say this. You wear a lot of green.
Get out of it.
You walk around singing old ditties from like Foster and Allen.
You've
always got a pint of Guinness glued to your hand.
Your favourite talk show host on talk radio is Eamon Holmes rather than Julia Hartley Brewer.
Well, it's wrong to have favourites, but yes, my genealogy requires that Eamon is number one.
Are you allowed to say that when you get up, you say to your relatives, top of the morning to you?
Yeah, I say it unironically. but I mean, Islamophobia is, I think, what you're getting at there.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there a risk of A, reprisals, and we hope there isn't, and B, a growing Islamophobia? And I'm sure that there will be portals online that will be, you know, confecting that up as we speak.
Well, I saw the press conference by the Manchester Mosque after the Ariana Grande attack, and they were talking about Salman Abedi. who was a worshipper at that mosque.
Mm.
And I felt two things. I thought that number one, the chairman of the mosque performed quite poorly. And I think his performance in front of the cameras was embarrassing. But fundamentally, this was just some old guy who, you know, now is the chairman of a religious institution and now has to stand up and talk about terrorism. Now, the fact that he wasn't very good in what he said and didn't say what the media wanted to say was because of because fundamentally he didn't know what to do. And I think that is the big problem here, isn't it? You know, people are ending up shoved into a situation by these crass, obnoxious bullies like the terrorist we saw today. They're pushed into this situation and they don't know how to cope with it.
I thought James Whale's coverage was fantastic tonight. James had trouble getting in and got on air at 8, and it's so he lost an hour of his show. You should never take any airtime away from James Whale.
No.
Because that is like blood to Dracula,
yeah,
just being
right.
on air.
That's right.
And he, when he got on air, he was obviously, as we're hoping to do, keep you fully informed about events.
Yes.
And things have calmed down now, though the streets are cordoned off, but we are where we are. It's a static situation out there. It's odd that we're still in the heart of it, and when we leave the studio tonight, we'll walk past an army of policemen and women.
Well,
by the way, freezing their socks off because it's very cold out there tonight.
Well, of course, the other thing about James Whale was, and James Whale is still James Whale always and forever. So we got the call, so the building's in lockdown. Nobody can come in or out. We are at the TV studio downstairs. The talk radio's on the 14th floor. The lifts are closed. So you and I are going to run up 14
and
flights.
And you weren't happy when you saw the lifts were shut.
Yeah, well, 14 flights of stairs was not. I mean, look, I'm not being funny, right? What are you, 40, 45 years
Andre
old,
Andre loves
right?
a lift.
Listen, you 45...
See, I always walk up.
Can I
know that staircase.
Can I tell you something? You would have had almost as much difficulty as me. But anyway, when we're here, you know, it's not like the dream team's here, but Dolan and Walker have turned up to take over because nobody
I'm
else
so
can get
sorry.
In.
Sorry, I hate to contradict you, but I've had an interaction via social media and it is from, and I'll get this for you.
Well, okay,
right now.
Can I tell you this? I walked in and I don't know if you heard this. James Whale went, don't worry, I'm here. Oh, what, they were going to put you two on? No, don't worry. I managed to make it in. You two are no good. And that was it. Like, it wasn't, thanks, Andre. Thanks, Mark, for turning up. It was, don't worry, I made it in. Now go home.
Well, that is exactly as it should be. I will find this tweet, which is very
oh no, I've got it.
Supportive. Of course you do.
It.
You've probably saved it. You probably put it.
No,
on
I tried to retweet it.
A pinned
didn't
tweet.
I?
Of course you did. What we'll do is we have a bank of material from various important public figures: Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Leader of the Opposition Jeremy Corbyn, Sadiq Khan, who is the Mayor of London, of course. And we will just talk further on this. It's Mark Dolan, Andre Walker on Talk Radio.
The 21st Century Dream Team of dialogue, debate and discourse.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio here. Thank you very much for joining us. It's late. It is the late night show. Ian Lee is away and Ian Lee, the best of Ian Lee tomorrow night.
It is.
Which is the most difficult job on Talk Radio is the editor of the best of Ian Lee because you are dealing with multiple hours of radio gold, legend, late night icon, Ian Lee. So the best of Ian Lee, but he's got quite a difficult job tomorrow night.
In what sense?
He's got to follow Andre Walker and Mark Dolan.
Oh, yes, of course, on fake news.
Yes.
You know, can I tell you something? I say this at every single time I present on Talk Radio. You and I are kind of at the vanguard of the YouTube channel that Talk
yes,
Radio has set up.
Correct.
And we do an awful lot on it and work in the TV studios downstairs. That YouTube channel is really, really good. Now, at the moment, not that many people subscribe to it. It's like 50,000 or something.
Thousands.
But we want
hundreds of thousands.
Well, no, but I'll tell you something. It's absolutely superb. So here's what you can get on it. You can get Julia Hartley-Brill one-on-one interviews, fake news, James Whale breaks the news, which is brilliant.
Cracking
you
show.
Get the best of all the shows, whether that be stuff with Ian Lee, whether that be stuff with Eamon Holmes, whether that be stuff with Matthew Wright.
Matthew Wright.
You know, in terms
Mike
of
Mike Graham, MG.
Mike Graham.
The king of mid-mornings.
Can I tell you, it is absolutely jam-packed full of brilliant, brilliant stuff. And I always go on about it because I've never known anybody who has subscribed and then been disappointed afterwards.
No, I do agree. It's a world of content. And what we do at Fake News is that we have a bit of a laugh about the week's big stories.
We do.
And we were down there pre-recording the show. I mean, we do it the day before.
Yes.
Because, you know, normally that's close enough to air for it to be ultra topical, which mm-hmm. it is. And we all met for our sort of pre-show meeting just as this drama unfolded.
Yeah.
Right in this location. And I do hope, as you're listening to this, that we're not being too sort of talk radio centric about it, because it does so happen that this yes. has happened right where we work. But I feel that this is, I mean, this will be a global news story. This isn't yeah. just a UK story, is it? There will be every website. I mean, you're a newspaper columnist as well. There's not a news website in the world that will not have this as the front page, I would have thought, for the foreseeable and next 24 hours.
But are we allowed to, well, I'm saying it now, but you know, the one thing that I wasn't sure about with fake news today, that we filmed today for tomorrow, was that obviously we normally have you, me, Dave Chawner, and two guests.
Correct.
Well, fairly obviously, because of the terror attack, we weren't able to have two guests, because one of them was just standing half a mile down the road outside of police cordon.
It was, you know, the star of the Mash report, Steve N. Allen,
who
tried to get in the building, but he was outside. And yep. I know he's quite athletic, and I just texted him, I just said, do a Tom Cruise and get in this building.
But I just wondered whether, when the producers decided that we shouldn't mention that on air, and actually what we should
when
do is
when you say
just,
the producers, I mean, it's a man called Chuck. There's nothing
Chuck,
else.
When Chuck said, let's not mention.
If Chuck goes down, that's it. Fake news is over.
But if
Chuck gets the flu, we're in trouble.
When Chuck said, let's not mention that, and let's just do it with the four of us rather than five, I was almost like saying, you know what we should be saying? No, we're going to carry on regardless. You know, we've not got a full complement of people for this show, but we're still going to make the show brilliant. And the show was first class because our backs were against the wall.
Well, yeah, and what we did is we had you and we had Dave Chawner and we had a very talented journalist and comedian called Sean. Do you remember his surname?
No, but he was only a little fella, wasn't
that's
he?
That's not awkward, is it? Let's just call him Sean. He was fantastic. You'll have to listen to the show anyway, but it's very good. But we were down there and we carried on with the show.
We did.
And we were stuck there. We couldn't use the lifts.
Nope.
And you were mainly worried that we would run out of food. This was your big concern.
No, my concern was, so remember, we knew that we were going to be in here for hours and hours on end. So this was 2 o'clock, and I think we were allowed to leave at 8 o'clock,
yeah,
something like that. So we knew we were in for the long haul. So I said, well, that's not a big deal. Let's go up to the canteen. Well, of course, they'd shut the lifts, so we weren't allowed. And by the way, they'd only shut the lifts for the ground floor and the first floor, because beyond that, you know how, who was it? One of the guests,
was it Simon Trundle?
Simon Trundle was saying
counter-terrorism
about outer perimeters and inner perimeters. Yeah. Well, of course, we were inside the outer perimeter, but outside the inner perimeter, if that makes any sense.
I don't know, it sounds disgusting.
We couldn't.
Andre, it's a family show, careful. here's the thing about it. So James, and I touched on it earlier, James was on air and dealt, you know, very well with it. Dan Wooten as well did an amazing job. In fact, Dan really had to handle the whole of that sort of breaking story.
Yeah.
But James immediately asked whether police should be armed. And what's your view, not only on that question, but ought we be asking questions like that so soon?
Well, we've been asking that question for a significant amount of time. And actually, and I'm sorry to say this, James Whale is an amazing man, but even great people are wrong on occasions. And in truth, the police themselves, the Police Federation, do not support arming police officers, simply because you end up in a situation like in the United States of America where use of a firearm becomes routine. Mm. And that's something that we don't want in the UK. Similarly, police accept that there are certain specialist functions that not all officers are capable of undertaking. That might be, you know, the guys who do the driving, chasing joyriders. That might be the guys who are on horseback, or it might be the firearms unit. And police officers themselves, and they are the most professional police in the world, that is widely accepted, have judged themselves that not all police officers should be armed. Now, what the Police Federation says that all police officers should have is a taser. Now, remember, that can be lethal on occasion. So a taser is a pretty dangerous weapon.
And of course, there have been some proceedings against police authorities who have tasered someone who has then died, maybe in relation to a health condition, or maybe just because, as you said, it is a powerful weapon.
But Mark, if you give a taser to every police officer, more people will get tasered. If you give a gun to every police officer, more people will get shot. And so you've got to have that balance. And so I think it was right today that we saw heavily armed and incredibly well-trained firearms officers
available.
Flat pack, the terrorist, which to use Phil Campion's phrase. And by the way, I love that because I think it's appropriately dismissive of the individual concerned. We saw that, but equally, we saw today that not every police officer did need to be armed. There was a lot of work that took place in terms of securing perimeters, in terms of searching, in terms of evacuating people, where officers with their normal equipment were perfectly capable.
Well, I agree with you also. I think you used a key word there, which was normalise. And yes. I think that if just the sight of every police person, man or woman, policewoman, policeman, armed with a gun. I mean, when I travel to Italy, Germany, France, Spain, and there's a lot more armed cops, and just the sight of a gun, it's a little traumatic just to see. I feel a little nervous around armed cops. And I think therefore just the sight of it, or even on a, you know, police operative, is enough to desensitize you to what is, you know, an unedifying device. I mean, guns are just wretched things, aren't they?
But the police are not agents of the state. It is a citizenry police force, a way of us looking after ourselves rather than being kind of paramilitaries that come in and tell us what to do. But I think we can go too far the other way. And I was not, I wouldn't say a friend, but I used to occasionally drink in the sports and social bar at the House of Commons with PC Keith Palmer, who was killed on the entrance of Carriage Gate.
Tragically.
When he was stabbed. Now, what frustrated me about Keith Palmer was the following. This guy used to be a soldier in the Royal Artillery, so he was somebody who had some firearms experience. He was somebody who was guarding a gate that was clearly a target to terrorists. And essentially, why did he not have a gun? Well, it would look bad on tourists. Photos. Now, I understand the sentiment, but that was remiss of the leadership of the police.
Yeah, for sure. So it's important that some officers have guns, that they're trained to a high level to use them, and that the rest of our police force exercise their amazing interpersonal skills.
Well, hang on, police.
Their eyes, their ears.
It's not police force, it's police service. They're not there to be a force, they're there to be a service, and I think it's an important distinction in terms of our phraseology. Because, you know, if you go to somewhere like France, France is an incredibly authoritarian country. I'm not saying it's a bad country, but it is authoritarian.
And actually, the cops in Italy are very heavy-handed too, I've noticed.
Yeah, whereas in Britain, any time a police officer does anything, even if it's, and I'm not condoning this, giving somebody a slap that perhaps they weren't meant to, we all go into meltdown because we are so nervous about having police that tells what to do. One of the reasons that we do not carry ID is not so much that I have a problem with carrying ID, I carry loads of it. The reason we don't have a national identity card is the idea that a police officer can walk up to you and say, ID please. No. I'm a free person in a free country. I'm not going to identify myself unless I'm accused of some sort of wrongdoing.
I find also, and I don't know if it's the nature of the British people or if it's a specific part of the training, but I find that whenever I've been at the wrong end of the law,
oh, come on.
Whenever I've had my collar felt, let's say I'm doing, and I don't condone this, but 23, 24 miles an hour in a 20 zone.
Oh, get out of it.
Or let's say I've
80 in a 70 zone.
I've accidentally come into contact with a jazz cigarette, which was placed in my hand.
When? At university?
No, I started that when I worked on fake news with you because it was so... No, definitely not. Well, I don't know.
By the way, talking of getting into trouble.
You see, you made me all nervous now. Sorry, I was all tongue-tied for the first time.
Sorry, talking of getting into trouble, there is a journalist, and I'm not going to say who it is. There's a journalist who is well-known, fairly highly decorated, got a great reputation, you know, somebody that people would recognise the face of, and probably the name as well, who also went to Edinburgh University and has an ASBO preventing him smoking cannabis or playing trance music in the city of Edinburgh.
I don't know if that makes him an undesirable or a bit of a legend.
Well, I have to say, if you are a famous journalist...
Only on the dance music, by the way. I've got to be honest. Not the narcotics.
I've got to be honest with you. There is something quite cool about being able to say, well, what's the most interesting thing about you? Well, I'm probably the only person with both a university degree and an ASBO.
Definitely. And I hasten to add, we don't make light of ASBOs, of drug use. I'm 100% obedient of the law. But you know when, let's say you've just, I don't know, I mean, I go around on my motorbike and, you know, I do, they call this filtering, where you more or less overtake stationary cars that are in traffic.
Right.
And
Are you not allowed to do that?
Well, in my defense, I was taught to do that when I was learning to ride a motorbike.
Right, okay.
And actually, I failed my first motorbike test for riding too slowly.
But I thought that was the whole point of a motorbike, that you can get through traffic.
Well, exactly, and this would be my argument. But occasionally, you know, I might have just been a little cavalier in my riding style.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been pulled over, but that moment when it's like, is that a blue light just behind me?
Yeah,
and it flashes in your wing mirror, and then you just get, your skin turns cold, the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And what I find is whenever I've been in a little bit of, you know, gentle trouble with the law, They seem to always talk to you. It's like a conversation.
Yeah.
And they'll say, did you see that red light, sir? You know,
yeah.
And there's a sort of gentle, there's a little levity there. There's a tiny touch of irony in their delivery, don't you think?
Do you
and it's not just a case of like a SWAT team that just throws you to the ground or whatever, but rather, anyway, I've been very long-winded about it and I apologize, but I just want to say, if ever I've like had contact with a police officer, I feel like they talk to you, and if you're reasonable and you identify and accept that you were in the wrong and you don't try to challenge their power,
yeah,
then I find that quite often they go, on you go, don't do it again.
But of course the other thing is, if you were talking specifically about traffic police, remember something, that you get pulled over because your child is not wearing a seatbelt by a guy who yesterday scraped someone up off the floor for not wearing a seatbelt.
And
so consequently, when you go, it'll be fine, he's a guy who day in, day out, knows that it might well not be fine.
I completely agree.
That's why they're not so much having a go at you. They're more begging you to not behave in that way and not put yourself at risk.
Yes.
By the way, there was the old sketch.
Words of wisdom.
Do you remember the old sketch where a police officer...
It's very late in the day for you to get so coherent.
Police officer knocks on a guy's window and goes, excuse me, sir, have we been drinking tonight? Well, we've never been drinking, but I've been down the pub.
Now, Martin Kellner goes on air at 1 o'clock, and you are the king of late night.
Ridiculous, not late nights, early morning.
And therefore, what we thought we'd do, we thought 4 hours is not enough, let's drag you in early.
Yeah, 4 hours is nowhere near enough for everything else. So I'll tell you what about police identity cards, my view on that. You know, you were saying about everybody carrying an identity card. I think the culture of this country is so sort of tied up with the Second World War, because for those of us who were born in the 50s and 60s, it was still very, you know, it was very close to us. And the movies were, you know, Second World War movies, all the black and white films and all that. And we associate identity cards with the Nazis.
With papers? Give me your papers?
Precisely. Yeah. I want your papers. And that sort of thing. And that's why we've always been so resistant.
But also, it's abstract to be a British citizen. You don't feel like a free spirit if there's this document that you have to have in your pocket at all
which
times.
Which, of course, remember, makes absolutely no practical difference, because our wallets are absolutely filled with things. And also, whilst an ID card is not mandatory, you need a driver's license to drive and a passport to leave the country. So.
We know all that. It's just the actual image. The image. It's part of the culture. You know, we say, oh, not carrying an identity card, but we can go onto Facebook and put where we live, what films we like, what books we've bought, et cetera, et cetera. So it's ridiculous.
You always get these what is your like adult entertainment name, and it's things like mother's maiden name and bank accounts, and you post it.
Now this handover, which is you know, it can be an awkward bit of radio because you quite often have two big egos. One's outgoing, about to hand over to. There's rivalry. There's jealousy.
Yes.
The opposite's the case for us.
Well, bless you for saying
because
that.
Because I
always think this is like Alan Partridge's handover at the end of his show.
Such is the level of my personal debt that I'm still a jobbing circuit comedian.
Yes.
And therefore, in the early hours on my way back from the back of beyond, I'm listening to your dulcet tones via DAB through my... It's a complicated process.
We're very much hoping to get up to double figures by Christmas. That's our goal. And now we've got another one to add to the list. That's fantastic.
Definitely. And it's always a treat. And it's always a packed show. And you've got a hashtag going already. Soup Lovers Film Club, which I'm very engaged with.
Well, let me tell you, I got the worst bit of PR. Have you got time? Have you got much time
for
this?
I've got about 70 seconds for you.
70 seconds, right. I got an email this morning from PR. We all get them, don't we, from PR firms saying, would you like to do a story on this? I've resisted doing a story on this, but I'll read the if I can find my
blurb.
If I can find my thing, I will read you.
I've got my own website, and I get so much of that now. I reply. Yeah. I get into like group chats with these people.
I do as well, and I can't find my flipping. Here we are. Right, this came this morning. This is my big story of the day. Here we go. Revealed. Soup is London's favourite winter dish. Hi, Martin. Wonder if the stats below might be worth a plug. As the nation braves the coldest November of the decade, new research commissioned by stock brand Knorr has revealed that London's favourite winter warmer is soup. See, I'd have put my money on ice cream, but there you are. It's soup. The research also looks at the UK's seasonal eating habits, revealing a switch in style of cooking as the temperature dips. Do you know what people do? More stock cubes.
And on that note, that's 4 hours of radio. Yes. Thanks to Sam. Thanks for Rudd. We'll be back soon.
This is Talk Radio.